welcome to Mr. Munting and also to Ms. Ramagaga, who will talk to us on the document, form that Mr. Munting's document is being reproduced with the bigger font, so that should arrive shortly. Before we start, can I humbly request that we rise for a moment of silence on the passing of Bishop Dolan. Thank you very much. Background to our and also welcome to the department. I am from the department is here, the deputy ministry, and to PMG and everybody else, welcome. We, as this committee, are almost 50% of our term. And at the beginning, we took a conscious decision that we're going to make meaningful changes in at least four areas. Seven, I think, were the pillars at the time. And then we think that the that this committee at its very first meeting agreed on seven pillars that we were going to focus on. We've reached 50% or just close to 50% of our term. And therefore the intention of this meeting really is not to rehash what came out from the Dali Commission. It really is for people to say to us, what is it that needs to be done? We're meeting the department on the 7th of September. And the outcome of our countrywide visits for the past 2 years, the outcome of our numerous correspondences that we've received from stakeholders and from inmates, and your interaction will assist us in asking the department on the 7th, what is it that you have done, and please explain why you have not done something. That really is what we're going to do. We are no longer going to discuss the merits or the demerits of the Dali Commission. So we want members, when they do their presentation, to assist us in that regard. We're really interested in what you think the department must concretely do that is measurable, that is achievable, to be able to address the ills of correctional services. Lots has been done, but clearly, ladies and gentlemen, lots more still needs be done. Just from all the observations that we've picked up, lots more still needs to be done. So really what we're asking you to tell us today, Mr. Munting and Ms. Ramagaga, is what is it that you as South African citizens are saying correctional services must do? Certainly in the next 2 years, by the time I leave office, I must be able to say these are the things that we've done. that have made life better in correctional services, learning from the Darling Commission report. I think that report is 5, 6, 7 years old. And we will pose that to the minister and to Kinamuzi and everybody else on the 7th. What have you done about the issues raised? So that really is our interaction today. We're hoping for it to be done with by 12:30 at the absolute latest. The committee will then spend a few minutes just going through our own internal business. So I'm not sure how long you prepared or how long Cindy gave you to do it, but it is now just past 10. Can we agree that starting with the input from Mrs. Ramagaga, I'm not sure, Mrs. Ramagaga, if 20 minutes, 25 minutes is sufficient for you, so that we engage with it and we do the same work with Mr. Munting. I'm not sure how much time you've budgeted for, but certainly 30 minutes will be maximum from your side, so that members can then engage with your presentation. Is that okay with members? Thank you very much. Ma'am, over to you.
Morning to the Portfolio Committee, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, members of the media present, and the Department of Correctional Services. We would like to thank the Portfolio Committee on Correctional Services for the invitation to make a submission about the progress made by the Department in implementing the recommendations of the Jolly Commission. The shortcomings identified by the Commission related to, amongst other things, corruption, maladministration, ill treatment of prisoners, and dysfunctional relationships between staff and inmates. The Commission described a toxic environment in which it was most difficult, if not impossible, for staff to deliver the quality of service required by the White Paper on Correctional Services. This being the case, it was clear that fundamental changes were necessary in the Department at all levels to overcome the subculture of corruption and human rights abuses that existed in many correctional facilities. It would be a disservice to staff of the Department, inmates, and taxpayers if the findings and recommendations of the Commission were not implemented. This notwithstanding, given the depth and seriousness of the problems identified by the Commission, it is unlikely that all the challenges highlighted by the Commission would have been addressed, particularly those relating to the appointment and management of staff after the 5 years or so since the report was made public. In this respect, civil society and civilian oversight structures, such as the committee, have an important role in assessing the extent to which there is ongoing improvement. I'm not going to go into the background establishment of the Jolly Commission. I'm just going to highlight the main focus of the submission. We'll be focusing on the management of staff and offenders, as well as the principles and practical steps for monitoring implementation of the Jolly Commission recommendations. We would like to remind the committee that the DCS spends about 26% of its budget on administration, which provides the administrative, management, financial, information and communications, technology, research, policy coordination, and good governance support functions necessary for all service delivery by the department and in support of the functions of the ministry. With such a significant percentage of the budget being spent on these functions, it is essential that systems responsible for ensuring good management and employment practices, as addressed in the Commission's report, be robust. The management of staff and offenders. The very nature of prisons is such that wardens wield an enormous amount of power over inmates. The Correctional Services Act requires the department and its staff to ensure the detention of inmates in conditions that uphold their dignity and promote social responsibility and human development. It is therefore up to staff of the department to ensure the safe custody of inmates, which includes the absence of corrupt practices and the availability of opportunities for inmate development. So These prisons are closed institutions. What takes place on a daily basis inside prison walls is not readily open to scrutiny. In order for conditions to be created that meet the requirements of the Act and the White Paper, an ethos of compassion and integrity amongst correctional services staff is essential. The situation in the 9 prisons investigated by the Charlie Commission report is the very antithesis of this. In some respects, this problem can be traced back to the shortcomings of the post-apartheid transformation of the DCS. The Charlie Commission found that the transformation of the DCS, in particular the demilitarization of the DCS, has been poorly executed with serious negative consequences. In particular, the Commission found that when demilitarization was implemented, no new management principles and procedures were put in to replace the military system staff were familiar with. The Commission went on to say that there is scant evidence of attempts to train members in better ways of dealing with the demilitarized environment or to develop new civilian methods to maintain order and discipline. This unstructured approach led to workplace tension and happiness and eventually a drop in the morale of senior members. The findings of the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services in the 2008-09 financial year and 2019 financial year in relation to the level of inmate-on-inmate violence and member-on-inmate violence suggests that these problems have yet to be overcome. It also suggests that staff still do not have the tools to deal with inmate indiscipline in a humane way. In the 2008-09 financial year, the Judicial Inspectorate recorded 2,884 incidences of inmate-on-inmate assault, and there's a little bit of a typo here, and 2010, it's supposed to read that the Judicial Inspectorate recorded 2,884 incidences of inmate-on-inmate assault and 2,010 cases of member-on-inmate assault. A year later, the number of recorded incidences of assault in both categories had increased in the 2009-10 financial year. There were 3,756 cases of inmate-on-inmate assaults recorded by the Judicial Inspectorate and 2,189 cases of member-on-inmate assault. In other words, it would appear that any efforts undertaken by the DCS to address these problems would not have been sustainable and have not resulted in fundamental changes in the way in which staff at prison level relate to inmates. Many of the staff behavioral problems were compounded by the fact that the rules and regulations imposed by the department had little impact, as individual staff members had not been held accountable for them. The Commission found that employees consciously and deliberately flouted regulations relating to security, searching of members, searching of visitors, visitation rights, procurement of goods for the prisoners, the relationship between staff, between prisoners and warders, recruitment and appointment, promotions, merit awards, transfer, parole, disclosure of private work, treatment of prisoners, use of state assets, and others. This appeared to be done with impunity in that there was little evidence of disciplinary action being taken against the transgressors. Finding the solutions to these problems and reversing the consequences of the failed transformation process while creating a new ethos in the department is a complex and difficult task. Such an undertaking requires at least strong leadership characterized by integrity with a clear focus on addressing the problems at all levels. Unfortunately, allegations of corruption, maladministration, and tender fraud amongst the highest levels of leadership continue to plague the department until very recently. In addition, organizational stability has not been served by the fact that the Commissioner of Correctional Services has been changed on 3 occasions since the Jolly Commission's findings were made public. Affecting the kind of fundamental change in the department that is necessary to overcome the problems identified by the Commission has been made even more difficult by the multiplicity of management process issues the department has had to deal with in the interim. We do not underestimate the enormous task facing the department. We are also conscious of the fact that the department is not the only department that has to deal with problems of this nature and magnitude. As you know, the SAPS has also battled to deal with police corruption, poor and poor staff morale while undergoing massive organizational restructuring while experiencing mismanagement corruption at the highest levels. The challenge facing both the police and the DCS is to effect fundamental change in the integrity of the organization, as well as in the behavior and attitudes of staff and managers at all levels. Principles and practical steps for monitoring implementation of the Dali Commission's recommendations. Monitoring the implementation of the recommendations of Jolly Commission, of the Jolly Commission and the provisions of the Correctional Services Act at prison level requires a high level of transparency. It is very difficult for Parliament and civil society to hold the department and its officials at all levels accountable on the basis of aggregated data that is presented in the annual reports from the DCS and the Judicial Inspectorate. The information provided does not allow for a clear assessment to be made as to what takes place, what works, and what needs to be fixed at prison level. Media reports about problems in prison suggest that managers at head office level are themselves not entirely in touch with prison level activities. It is, however, our assessment on the basis of the findings of the Commission and the subsequent reports by the Judicial Inspectorate and the media that fundamental change needs to be effected both at prison level and head office level before we can be confident that the problems of corruption, human rights abuses, and mismanagement have been addressed. Indeed, in the 2007-8 financial year, the DCS noted that while implementation of Jolly Commission recommendations was a performance indicator for effectively dealing with corruption and fraud into the 9 management areas, the department was unable to provide frequent reports on progress due to the fact that the management areas have to be given time to implement recommendations. It would be useful to know from the department how the recommendations have been converted into performance indicators and whether the recommendations are regarded as being applicable only to 9 management areas or applied across the DCS. It is our understanding that the recommendations should apply to the DCS as a whole. It is not our wish to use this submission to merely criticize the department. We are deeply aware of the enormous challenges that an effective change management process poses. We are also aware of how difficult it is to achieve a fundamental change in the way in which work is done in a huge and complex organization like the DCS. As such, we should be mindful of the need for civil society and oversight structures to do more than stand on the sidelines and point to the problems without offering solutions. We suggest to the committee that fundamental change in the way in which prisons operate will require a comprehensive change management process, starting at head and regional offices and including all correctional facilities. This is important since head and regional officers have a key role in ensuring that staff at all levels have adequate managerial and policy tools and receive sufficient training and mentoring to do their jobs effectively. Such a change management process, we believe, should aim to involve prison-level staff in articulating a vision for the facility informed by the Correctional Services Act, ensure that all staff understand their own role in implementing the Act and know what needs to be done to ensure that their facility reflects the objectives of the Act. It should identify barriers to seek change and seek ways in which to deal with those problems. Such a process would require concerted support from head office. Further, we propose that a set of core indicators be developed and agreed on, against which it would be possible for the committee and civil society organizations to assess progress at prison level. Quarterly reporting against these indicators at prison level would allow us to monitor progress and hold staff at prison level accountable. It is proposed that these indicators be jointly developed in a consultative process that involves civil society, oversight structures, and the DCA. One such indicator, for example, might relate to the training of staff, not only at the time of initial recruitment, but also refresher training for existing staff. We would also like to draw the attention of the committee to the commitment of the department to using the compliance monitoring tool developed by the department to monitor and track implementation of the Correctional Services Act. This tool was referred to in the DCA's annual report of 2019, but is unfortunately not publicly available. We are also not aware of the content of this document. As such, we propose that the committee request the department to report on the implementation of this compliance monitoring tool as one way in which to hold the DCF accountable for ensuring compliance with the Act. Such a tool can offer civilian oversight structures with valuable information, and we encourage the committee to request the department to make the tool available to civil society. The DCS is to be commended for having concluded a series of contracts with the Special Investigating Unit to investigate corruption in response to the Jolly Commission recommendation that a special task team be set up by the department to deal with those guilty of misconduct. The findings of both SIU reports were subsequently reported to this committee in 2008 and 2009. Further, in 2011, the Portfolio Committee interrogated some of the findings of the report. We urge the committee to seek clarity on the intention of the DCS in relation to its ongoing relationship with the SIU, and for detail about cases dealt with by the department's investigating unit since the last contract with the SIU ended in 2009. The committee should also seek information about progress in the investigations against the officials implicated in corruption uncovered by the SIU. Since the prison system is largely closed to external scrutiny, whistleblowers have an important role to play in bringing incidences of corruption and human rights abuses to the attention of the authorities. It is therefore essential for the department to encourage and protect whistleblowers. We urge the committee to ask the DCS to report on measures it has put in place both to encourage and protect whistleblowers since the closure of the department's anti-corruption hotline. In conclusion, we recognize that the Portfolio Committee has done a great deal to hold the department accountable, and in encouraging civil society input to assess and report on aspects of the department's work. We thank the committee for this opportunity and remain available to assist the committee in its important work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Can you hear your comment? Comments, questions, critiques, anything towards the input? We take from Gwenya, followed by Mr. Dow.
Thank you, Jefferson. And also thank you for the presentation. Chair, as far as I'm listening to the presenter, I find myself not having questions, but I would like to agree with the presenter in terms of the discipline of members that are making corruption in our center. And in this document that they gave us on the first page, it's page 2, on the every field, the problem is reaching small legislators. Kepesin, they talk about the Department of Correctional Service, the treatment of prisoners. I agree with them in terms of the treatment of prisoners, that some of the things that the members that are doing are not correct. For example, where at St. George, where we found an inmate that was arrested with his brother, and the brother was killed by the staff, and that in their report they didn't put it that the inmate that was killed by the staff. And when we asked questions about that, we were told that we are going to get the report of that. They are still investigating. So it shows that there is a problem about the staff in our centers in terms of some of the things that are not trained services. And the discipline, in terms of discipline, we were told that the other members that have done something that is wrong, like to smuggle a dagger to the inmate, those members were not sentenced, but were just giving a warning or a suspended person who reminds me.
Written
warning. And to Shepherdson stated clear that to sell data in the prison is a criminal. But all those things, they're just putting under the carpet. So that's why, Chair, I said, instead of asking questions, I don't have questions, but I'm agreed about the report that what they are saying really is true. Therefore, we've got a long way to go to make things right in this in our centers in terms of pushing the department to do right things in terms of their staff. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Likewise, I'd like to thank the presenters. I'm particularly interested in the suggestion that is made at the top of page 7 of change management within the department, and specifically the idea of a center level, if you like, performance agreement contract, because I think it's an idea with a great deal of merit. But what I'd like, if possible, for the presenters to do is to unpack that paragraph in practical terms. Say, what would such a performance agreement look like? What are the sort of things that would form part of such a performance agreement? And also, given the fact that the labor relations regime in the public service as a whole and in the DCS in particular is a bit constrictive, is it possible, in practical terms or in legal terms for that matter, to provide a sort of performance contract of that nature, because it may just fall foul of collective agreements of all sorts of nature. So maybe a little bit more detail on that. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Magaga, I know you're not going to be able to be so comprehensive, but if you have to give an initial, it's fine. We welcome a more detailed one before we meet with the department on the 7th, but I'm sure Mr. Self is not expecting any detailed report now, but if you want to make initial comments, you're welcome. You want to know? Well, you're just thinking to apply your mind. All right? I'm reluctant to give it to the advocate, which will lose what wants to come out of that. on to them, and then we'll move on to the advocate, and then to Mr. Abram.
I just heard a question about that is on page 6, paragraph 4. So one of the media reports with regards to the knowledge in touch with personal activities, senior managers' knowledge towards operational activities. I think let me spot on, and this is my experience and previous experience and currently, that once you were exposed to that situation at operational level and you are promoted to senior top management, you can easily relate to problems and what sources needed to assist those in the operational side. With great respect, that recruiting from outside, people might bring into the department special, specialities into certain areas. But to place somebody from outside in charge of the standing operational functions is disastrous. Because it affects not only the morale, as indicated, it is also negatively affecting discipline, which is currently, in my view, respectfully, in non-existence. So I would like to urge the institution, whether it is possible to conduct a survey to determine how many senior and top management do have prior experience and how many, and we will discover, because rumors have it, there's a lot of the senior, the SMS managers came from outside. And if we are serious to really to address and arrest the situation and to implement and to ensure that those Dalit Commission recommendations have been implemented, we have to go back to basics. And that's it. Thank you so much.
No, let's start discussing rather than having that. There's a, I don't know, just on this one, because I see the young lady is still trying to deal with the first question. I think the issue that Mr. Max is raising is a debate around the usefulness of internal promotion versus external recruitment. Now, you as a stakeholder have an opportunity, because you're discussing that policy. You as a stakeholder have an opportunity of giving up your initial feeling. Mr. Max has put his point, so you guys can briefly respond to that. I'm not sure if you were talking to that same point. Okay. So, I'm saying on this one of Mr. Max, if you guys are to make initial comments on the wisdom or otherwise of internal versus external.
I agree with Mr. Max on his point, but I think there's a second dimension to that problem, and that is around policy development, because, and I'm trying not to tread on too many toes, but we've seen policies developed that we must seriously question as to their appropriateness and achievability and practicability in the department. our side have now been questioning the white paper in that way, that is it really achievable? Would experienced prison managers have developed this policy? And I think we can ask that question of other policies as well. Thank you.
Now, the question that I want you to answer, Mr. Munji, and anybody else, is what is your view on internal promotion versus external promotion? And are there negatives to that? Mr. Max is suggesting that there might have to be a relook at hiring from outside, and maybe we should take people with historic memory. I think that's what Mr. Max is saying. And you can give us your views, because we will discuss it on our own, on the merits or demerits of that as a committee, and then put it to the department. But what do you guys have any comment? If you don't have any comment, it's fine. We are putting in a opportunity to comment if you so wish. Anybody? Let me put it in layman's language. Mr. Max is suggesting that when we do promotion, we promote people that are in the country, because when they get to head office, they understand what's happening on the ground, as opposed to recruiting people from outside, because they come at head office level and they don't know what's happening on the ground. What are your comments to hear then?
Just to make it clear, I say that there might be positions which can be filled from the outside,
yes,
by the operational side.
Yes. Are there any comments? Because we will definitely put that to the department after we've given our own position.
Just very briefly, I think one needs to strike a balance, and it would be difficult to say, yes, we should not employ only internally and not externally, because in a transformation process, it is important to bring new blood in. On the other hand, we cannot lose those people who are experienced in the department. We must still provide them with a career in the department and not place a ceiling on them just because they came from the previous dispensation. So, but I think by my overview, it's not just about employing people. It is about retraining the entire department staff in a new way of running the prison system. But we must strike that balance, because what happens is that outside people are either undermined deliberately or just by their lack of knowledge and experience, and that they ultimately cannot operate the prison properly, and other officials, experienced officials, run in circles around them.
Ma'am, are you ready to give us the initial one, or would you not just do it in writing?
No, I just want to reply to he was asking about the change management process. Just in dealing with that question in detail, I'd rather send a summary of the detail of what it includes, but just on a brief mention, or just trying to unpack what I meant by change management process, is that the department needs to have a vision of ensuring that is inclusive, or that aims to involve prison-level staff, of ensuring that human rights abuses are addressed. And in order to do this, all prison staff need to be involved in the process, not just regional head office staff. Currently, the reports of the judicial inspectorate highlight the fact that staff do not know how to deal with indiscipline in prisons, and therefore a change management process needs to look at the current challenges that the prison level staff are facing and how those challenges can be addressed. And then in the question of, I think it was Mr. Max was asking about conducting a survey of prior experiences and so forth. I think that survey would have to be done firstly internally by the department, as opposed to having civil society conducting that survey, because we would need information from the department to actually conduct such a survey.
I'll come to you, sir. Baba, are you happy? Sal?
No.
You happy? All right. Lam, if you could give us something in writing. You're talking about training. You better tell us who you think should be doing the training, what type of training. I really think that we cannot go back to recreating. After 2.5 years in this department,
we'd have to come to a consensus. Your suggestion is that we ask the department to go away for 3 days, or ask the department to use 10% of their budget to employ this type of thing. That's what we want. We don't want the talk shop come September. Training people on human rights, maybe Macalester in September, so that we are able to say to the department, 10% of your budget must be used to do ABCD. So when in your response you can give us, as the staff has said, 4 or 5 concrete steps, because we are really moving away from debating now. We want to be able to say, why can't you implement this, or use your money to implement that one. If you can give that to us before the 7th when we meet the department. Yes, sir.
I'll use the opportunity to add a few points to Mr. Self's question. I think we can, and this was the intention behind the pilot prisons the whole time, is that these would be laboratories for the department to try out new things. Now, the department has keeps an eye over the private prisons by appointing controllers inside. Why is that system not used in the Department of Correctional Services on a more general basis? And one can follow an incremental process around that. I think, secondly, if what is talking about a new approach to managing prisons and we devolve responsibility to heads of prison, we must also make available to them the necessary budgetary resources. We cannot expect somebody to improve performance, yet they don't have the resources to employ people, social workers, whoever it is that are needed. But I think for me the most important thing is that there must be very clear and precise standards of what is the expectation of the head of prison. What is it that prison must achieve? And I think there is a lot of confusion. Heads of prison don't necessarily understand what it is that they must produce by the end of the year. And so we see prisons operating at very different standards, very confused management processes. We're currently busy with the survey on children in prison. The variety in results is astonishing. Just different interpretations of what must happen to children in prison. And that's a very small group of the prison population. Thank you.
Mr. Max, are you comfortable with your response up to now?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you.
Thank you, Munir Avram.
Why don't you go?
Chairperson, I want to thank the presenter for the presentation. Now, on page 6, under chapter 4, the second paragraph, you allude to your assessment about the basis of the findings of the commission and the subsequent reports of the Judicial Inspectorate regarding specifically the problems of corruption and maladministration. Now, you may recall that the Commission inter alia recommended that the Correctional Services Act be amended to provide for the Office of the Inspecting Judge to also deal with complaints of corruption and maladministration. Now, in your view, or in the stakeholders' view, do you think that is feasible? Do you think that the Office of the Inspectorate is sufficiently equipped and has the necessary capacity, human capacity, financial resources, to be able to carry out such a responsibility? Of course, financial resources can always be made available. Human capacity can be developed. But do you think that it should be stationed under the inspectorate? The second thing that I would like to put forward...
No, let's deal with that one first. We'll allow you for a second one. And it's not only to Mr. Ramakaga. We are supporting all of you if you want to comment on it. Just indicate and take all this, and then we'll move on. But we'll give you the first bite, because it's your presentation, and then your colleagues can, if they want to. Just on the first one.
I understand that the Judicial Inspectorate is currently in the process of trying to get an independent budget away from the department. But I do think that they do have some limitations in terms of investigating, because that is not part of their mandate. investigating acts of or human rights or violations against. Against officials and so forth. So I do understand that they do have, they are trying to get a separate budget from the department, but their current mandate is limited to only reporting on those cases. They cannot investigate those cases. So until such time that they can be given an extra mandate to investigate reports and so forth, then I think maybe they may be able to have more power. But currently, in the situation that it is, and I think Judicial Inspectorate needs to be given more power to investigate cases, as I said, instead of just reporting on incidences of abuse of human rights violations in the prison.
I'm going to differ from my colleague about the mandate of the Inspectorate. Section 90 provides for the reporting on corruption, but Section 90, subsection 5, says that the inspecting judge may conduct any investigation. There is nothing preventing the inspecting judge from investigating corruption. My interpretation is that the inspectorate has, over the years, focused more on the treatment and conditions of detention and deliberately steered away from corrupt and dishonest practices, perhaps against the background of the Jali Commission and the SIU's investigation. They did not perhaps feel it their place to conduct those investigations. But yeah, it's a policy decision for the inspectorate whether they want to embark in that avenue. From our side, we will definitely support such a move.
No, you see, what are you saying? We are asking you, what are you saying? He's putting the question. I think what you guys must say to us, as civil society, we think the department or the committee must direct the department in this way. In other words, give the inspecting judge more independence, give him more, whatever the case might be. So that when you give it to us, we will debate it amongst ourselves. We all know that this is what the inspecting judge needs to do. Things have not improved. What are you saying now about the inspecting judge? I think that's the question that he's putting. We have this animal called the inspecting judge there. Is it operating optimally, or what should be done for it to be operating optimally? And we are hearing that he's got the power to investigate. He's steered away from investigating corruption. If your view is that he should do it more and do less of something else, say so. So that we are able then to go and say, you know, this is what Munting has said. Do we agree or do we disagree with it? So that is the kind of response that we want from all of you. Because you provoke discussion here. We're going to ask you our questions and give us direct answers so that we can go away and decide whether we agree or disagree with you. Let's take Ms. Ariasi first, and we'll come back to Mr. Munting for sharing his program.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, apologies for my late coming. Just with regard to the Judicial Inspectorate role, I do agree that we need to, I know there's been legislative amendments, but there's still the issue of the enforcement of recommendations. And I think unless we deal with that issue, there's no way we can put more on to the plate of the Judicial Inspectorate, because it creates a lack of confidence on the ground level. If the Office of the Inspecting Judge, the prison visitors or whatever, come into the prison, investigate these things, and nothing happens with them. So unless we look at legislative amendments regarding enforcement of recommendations, I don't think we're going to go anywhere with anything else. So that's our thing.
Yeah, I think in my submission, I will essentially argue that what is required is active monitoring of the Jali Commission's recommendations, and I think the inspectorate can play an important role in that regard. Now, one can say maybe the inspectorate should develop its own capacity to investigate corruption, and that may be one way to do it. Alternatively, one can say the inspectorate should play an active role in monitoring and reporting other institutions of state investigating corruption and other rights violations. I think that is the two positions that one can debate further. The issue for me is really about how we
improve transparency in the criminal justice system, in the prison system? How do we get more information out? Because without transparency, it's very difficult to hold the department accountable for things that go wrong. Thank you.
Chair,
I'm very, very intrigued by the position taken there. What is of interest is that Ms. Pagliacci says that recommendations are made by the inspector. The inspectorate cannot execute, let's assume, any maladministration that they've seen or discovered or whatever. They are in no position to execute any form of action. Am I correct in terms of the current legislative framework? Jali Commission recommended that the Correctional Services Act be amended to give more teeth, shall I say, to the inspectorate. Are you then saying that in order to guarantee the legitimacy of the actions of the inspectorate, it has to have that kind of teeth? Otherwise, it will be seen merely as a toothless bulldog making a recommendation, and the implementation thereof depends on the department. Only the department can implement, or the state. So, are you saying that the Jali Commission recommendation ought to be carried out? Secondly, with regard to the whole issue of being able to investigate what sort of shortcomings do you see at the moment which inhibits an adequate investigation? Which sort of legislative impediments do you see? And what do you suggest ought to be done in order to remove such impediments, and what more teeth or power should the inspector have?
Yes, Chair, I think really flowing from Mr. Abram's question, it is true that the Act says what it says, and it's true that the Jali Commission recommended what it recommended. The difficulty, I think, that we have heard over the years from the point of view of the judicial inspectors, is that in order to do what is expected of them, they would require huge resources in addition to the resources they have at the moment, and they have difficulty enough in getting the resources they need in order to simply fulfill their current mandate. The second thing is, if you recollect when we were debating the amendment bill earlier this year, there was a whole long debate about jurisdiction and how far did the ambit of the judicial inspectors go, and at what point did it start infringing on the police, on the Department of Justice, on various other role players. Your comments on the issue of jurisdiction would be very helpful. And thirdly, I think that the other argument that we've heard over the years is that the job of inspecting the conditions of offenders in prison by the inspectorate requires a particular relationship between the inspectorate and the prison management in order to resolve difficulties, in order to get to the bottom of what is going on, and that you cannot do that if you're also the super policeman that is, in a sense, checking to see whether they're being honest. So I suppose the existential question that I'm asking is, if not the judicial inspection, then what? Because corruption was a problem in the Jali Commission time, it's still a problem. We all know it's still a problem. And it's not gotten any better. So what can we do in practical terms if not, for all the reasons that I've articulated, empower the judicial inspectors to do that? What else needs to happen in order to deal with it much more effectively than the case at the moment?
Okay. Before you respond, let me muddy the waters further, and then you'll respond. There's an argument that is being made that this notion that the inspecting judge must have power to enforce, not investigate, in fact erodes the power of the department. The department should be able to do the enforcing. You can't outsource the management to some independent body. You're eroding the power of the state by saying the inspecting judge must do the enforcement. Like Parliament and like everybody else, we as Parliament also don't have power to enforce anything. Our is persuasion as Parliament. So why must the inspecting judge be different to Parliament? We report on our findings. We hope that public pressure and your conscience will make you do the correct thing as government or whoever else. So there's that argument that is being put forward that says, well, the inspecting judge can pick up, investigate, and do all those things, but then report it and put it on the plate of the committee or on the plate of the public, but he certainly can't go and say to the national commissioner, thou shalt do X. I'm saying there's that argument that he's saying. Over and above these arguments that have been raised now, what are your views on those? Because those are the divergent arguments. Do you have any views on them? At the end of the day, we're going to have to take a decision as a committee. We're affording an opportunity to. If you can't do it now, it's fine, but answer all these questions that we are raising to you by the 7th of September when we meet the department. So we're giving you the whole effort. You have an opportunity to influence us in terms of how we take it. I'm not sure if anybody wants to have a bite at any of these things now, otherwise you are at liberty to write to us in terms of the responses. Anybody wants to comment on the issues around the inspecting judge? Yes, sir?
Very briefly, and I think it's all very valid, complex questions. I think the resources issue is the one that we must debunk immediately. The budget of the inspectorate, I think at the moment, is around about 17 million rand per year. It does not even constitute 0.5% of the department's budget. And the potential savings that one can expect by proper investigations, reporting, increased transparency will pay for itself very, very quickly. So I don't think we should entertain the resources argument. Yeah, let me stop there because the other.
When you say don't entertain it, you're saying that the department shouldn't argue that it's legal enough. There's room to give them more, or are you saying they're getting sufficient?
I think the judicial inspectorate should not hold back on asking for more resources. They should not think of that as a variable affecting the decision. If they want to do investigations around corruption, maladministration, and they believe that that will ultimately improve the conditions of detention and the way we treat prisoners on a daily basis, it will be in the best interest of the prisoners, and therefore we must do it and spend the necessary resources.
Thank you very much. Anybody else on the inspector desk?
Yes, I'd just like to comment on the suggestion that the department shouldn't outsource the enforcement powers and so forth, that they should be doing it internally and so forth. I think the question in that is that does the department have the capacity to ensure that recommendations brought forth by the judicial inspectorate to enforce those recommendations, do they have that capacity? If currently recommendations taken by the or given by the judicial inspectorate are not being enforced, do they have the internal capacity to do that if we're saying that it shouldn't be outsourced?
I mean, you can answer the other side of the question, but we'll allow you to attend it up. Does the inspecting judge have the capacity to do that? I no, you say the department doesn't, but if they can't do it anymore, you need to say to our so-and-so material so that we put these hard questions to the department. Let's take Vanessa and you, in whatever you want to say, sir. The question that I'm asking you, if we gave you the power to enforce, do you have the capacity to enforce? When your time arrives?
Okay.
When will your time arrive? Yes, ma'am.
You need to actually think about it and write it, but
yeah.
Just to make a comment, maybe answer a question with a question. The current system is not working. That we know. So we can't leave it the way it is. I understand your point about the oversight body can't enforce, but there is a real problem with accountability. And there's a history of the department, not only in the Jali Commission or the Inspector's Report, but every single investigation that is done within the DCS. These recommendations, some are just discarded. And that's a serious problem. Why are we even investing in so much if we're just not going to acknowledge them? And if somebody's not going to monitor and hold the department to account, then we're fighting a worthless battle. So, I may not have all the solutions. That is a complex question, but there is a serious problem with accountability, and it's not just the DCS. I think in this country, so I don't know if it's our system of government or how, but somehow we need to look at something that we can change.
What about your responses to DCS before the 7th of September so that we are able to say to them, do X, Y, and Z? And if it is because we're not doing enough, then say so. If the way the committee must operate is problematic, then you need to say that to us. But I agree. We can't have recommendations year in, year out. And that's why we're saying that today's meeting is no longer about talking about the Dalit community. We're talking about what the department must do. And that's why they're here. They'll come back with their answers to it. So if it means that the portfolio committee must spend less time in Cape Town and be in the field, say so. And we will enforce that through our mechanisms at Parliament. But you need to say to us what must be done. Sir, we wanted to say something, and over and above what you wanted to say, are you able, since no use these guys advocating for you to enforce, we give you that power and you're unable to do it, and we see an egg on our face. Your response, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I'm employed by the Judicial Inspectorate, as some of you may know. I think the short answer to your question is no. We don't have the capacity currently to enforce. 12 years in existence now, we've had a strategic planning session recently. We've reflected on what we've done and what we haven't done. And I don't want to, and of course that will be reported formally by the Inspecting Judge in our annual report, etc. But we have started to increase our capacity with a view to becoming more inquisitorial. I'm just giving you a general sense. And our commitment is to improve the quality of our oversight and to be more inquisitorial. I'll say that generally. So the short answer, Mr. Smith, Chairperson, to your question, do we have the capacity to enforce in terms of resources? No. I just want to throw some other thoughts out. I agree with Mr. Munting that the resource question, the financial resource question, should not be an issue. I don't have the act in front of me, but I think it reads that the department shall be responsible for the expenses of the Judicial Inspectorate. Of course, within the PFMA and all of those budgetary good governance kind of principles, the department, in terms of the act, cannot militate against what we want to do. Of course, then there are processes that we have to meander through with the department and its allocation of the budget. And I think that the committee probably plays an important role with regard to not just the department's budget, but ours and our intention to implement when you question the department with regard to its allocation. So sometimes there's the pool and it gets allocated. In theory, they should pay it. They do. We've never had serious problems with regard to them not paying the expenses of the inspectorate. But I think part of this umbilical cord that exists, and I think the judge has expressed himself before with regard to our administration is still linked to the department. So, practical example, if we have decided to create a post, we've got to go through the department, personal process. We would decide to create it, they would then create it. And I'll say this, that we've had problems with the post exists and it doesn't exist. We don't have control over that. So we could decide. We'd like to employ 5 more inspectors and investigators, etc. But it's determined by and dependent on a system out there. We've had discussions with the commissioner. The judge recently, in fact, had discussions with the commissioner, and we're trying to break that logjam. And I suppose the judge will speak a little more about that as well. He's spoken to him recently. So that deals with the resources question. The question of powers, and I'll express my own opinion here. Firstly, let me put it this way. It's fine to be given powers. We've debated this internally, and I know the inspecting judge has expressed himself with regard to, I go there, I see an infringement, and it's patent, and I'd like to reverse that situation. Some of them could be easy, where you can instruct the head of the center, etc. Others may not be, and if we talk about corruption and maladministration, besides resources, you have the labor relations regime comes in. You make an allegation. You have long investigations. And we're not a court. We're judicial inspectorate because of, by virtue of the judge. But I'm just saying, and I just throw this out as points for debate with regard to if we had the power to enforce, and we can, there are many genres of which areas. It might be easy to say, give the inmate his privileges, or give the inmate whatever it is kind of thing. When it comes to maladministration and corruption, and you're fingering a head of a center, for example, for scratching in the till, we are, of course, I suppose, we could investigate, inquire, etc. And then the labor relations process will stop us. And also, my own view is that we the department must manage those things. We can identify it. We can report on it. And I think it's important that when we report, this committee, civil society, etc. And I think the symbiotic relationship between the whole criminal justice system and this committee is important. So I express my own view. It's fine. I mean, we'd like more power and say, we now have the power to enforce. But it's going to create a whole new, in my view, bureaucracy. And we take away the jurisdiction and the obligation of the SIU and steps and all of those kind of things. Just one thing, and I'll just throw this out as well.
Last
little bit. You'll notice that in our annual report, the previous, we went a little further and we looked at death a little more closely. And we deliberately raised the question of whether the department themselves in an investigation of a death indicated that they would discipline. We've recorded that. We will report again as to what the follow-up there was. Now, that's our intention, to say, look, this is, we've traded it a little bit further. Then also, the last thing, with SAP, and I'll say this, you can anticipate in our next annual report, the responses that SAP gives, remember, for every death, for example, the department must collate all information, not just what had happened inside, whether an inquest has been held, whether criminal prosecution has been held, any comments by the presiding judge, etc., etc. And that relationship we've identified, and we'll put it out into the public, seems, it doesn't turn the full circle, so the circle is not complete. And we've put that in our last annual report, if you look at it again, with regard to the South African Police Services investigating, criminally prosecuting, and or inquests. When we attend the last sentence, I'll say now, when I attend the local case law management meetings under the auspices of Judge Lope and the regional court president, they will tell you we don't have the resources. Now, if we just talk about death, inquests are invariably done in papers, in chambers. They look at the affidavits and never open. And I'm saying that this committee, in my view, should interact, and I think we made that suggestion the last time, with the portfolio committee on CAPS. And ask CAPS, why are those dockets not complete? With justice, how many of those inquests in respect of prisons are completed? That's just one example. I thought I'd just throw some of those thoughts out. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair Tata. Do you think the instability or capacity at management level contribute to the slow or non-implementation of the same of the recommendation by Judge Commission?
again, Mr. Ramakanta, but prior to anybody else, if you have any response, if you don't have a response, not in a position, you don't have to respond if you don't need.
I just need a clarification of the question. Is she asking management?
She's asking if management is unstable and, okay. Well, I think, okay, and I think that had been mentioned by the Jolly Commission. Hence, we were talking about, well, in terms of the Jolly Commission, they didn't, in fact, investigate or look into head or regional offices, but they did look into the 9 management areas. And it was clear from the report that there were issues in terms of managing those prisons. And then if you look at page 7 of the document, we talk about a change in change management process, which we believe should aim to involve prison-level staff. They were speaking to, obviously, the 9 management areas that were investigated in articulating a vision for their facilities. So obviously, yes, we would say that instability with management does affect or has an effect on how prisons or the facilities are run.
That one?
More related to the response from Mr. Alda.
So before you do that, Mamnyanda, are you happy with the response to the Yes, sir.
I just want to, because Chairperson, you also asked if the committee must do something different than we must raise it. Section 93 of the Act says that the inspecting judge must submit a report on each inspection undertaken. And my question is that being done, or is the annual report regarded as the inspection report? Because if there are more detailed inspection reports, I think those would go a long way to promote transparency, but also enable civil society organizations to monitor the issues that are being raised by the inspectorate. I think, secondly, if one is now dishing out advice, that the inspectorate can do or publish more, do more research than what is currently contained in the annual reports. A thematic report on corruption, petty corruption, on health, conditions of detention, those are the things that not only civil society, but I think also the department need guidance on. How do we interpret these things? And then thirdly, maybe it will be wise to look at the mandate of the Independent Complaints Directorate, how they investigate death and serious rights violations, and see if one can expand the judicial inspectorate mandate in that direction, where they investigate, prepare a docket, and ultimately give the docket to the prosecution service. Thank you.
All right. Baba, you heard what they said. We're not going to even debate this thing. I think to answer your question, we get them, but we don't do enough. So as from today, the inspecting judge will be called to this committee at least quarterly, as we do with the department. So gear yourself up that you'll also have a good answering the question, what have you done from the last meeting to this meeting? That will talk to the transparency, it will talk to the reports that they give us. Definitely not going to debate, we will just add that into our program. The inspecting judge will come and give us regular updates. Babanjo.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to make 2 comments, Chairperson. First, the comment about the parole. I've seen on Mr. Mazarin that there was nothing said about the parole. There was a lot of confusion about where we've in the center. A lot of confusion has taken place from the inmates. And again, it's one of the recommendations of the Jolly Commission about the parole system and so on. And again, the parole system has been challenged, as we all know, that in the Constitutional Court and so on. We haven't heard anything about it. If there are any comments about the parole, because the inmates have a problem of not knowing exactly what they should do and when they should do it, and who should assist them, and so on and so forth. Those are the things that have happened.
Secondly, Jefferson is the tool that is around our hand in terms of.
Anybody wants to make any comments around the parole as it is referred to in the study committee, didn't cover it that fast. Anybody else want to comment on that? No? No? Forever. Abraham can do for the Nazi guys.
If you mean that in their submissions they never considered the parole part in the Danish Commission, that one we will take out of the stage.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now, chapter 7 on page 7, Mr. Mugal talk about the tool that is not available. I'll try to understand if the tool is not available. Were they supposed to get the tool? What do they need to get the tool? It's just a simple question. Because he said that the tool is not available. Unfortunately, it's not available for public. They were supposed to get the tool. Where did they get the tool? What is the tool all about? I'm just asking that question for a simple understanding.
Yeah, I'll just transfer the question to Mr. Manton because he knows more about the tool than we do.
Thank you. The tool being referred to is the Correctional Services Act Monitoring System. It has its history in the partnership agreement between the Open Society Foundation, the donor agency, and the department. UWC, where I'm based, was appointed as the service provider, and I was the project manager. We developed that tool. It is completed. It took the best part of 6 years. I am bound by a confidentiality agreement, so I can't disclose anything more than that, than what is available in the public domain. I can only advise the committee to ask the department for a briefing on the Correctional Services Act monitoring system.
Are you guys following what the committee is saying? So that when we ask the question, at least we know what you're talking about. So when you talk about this monitoring tool, at least you know what you're talking about.
I understand what
not the
is.
Content,
yeah.
But the update in terms of
what is
happening with that tool, yeah. Because I think that's the recommendation that we should ask you guys on the 7th. So that when we ask you on the 7th, you're not going to say, sir, what are you talking about? Because Munti won't be here to explain. It will be up to us to explain it. So we're hoping that you at least get it. That's how we're going to ask you. What are you doing about this tool? Nina is good with the A. What is
the tool? Yeah.
But the problem I'm facing, I follow what you're saying, sir. If the tool is not available for the public and for the department and so on, As far as the presentation is saying, and as far as what Mr. Manton is saying, that he can't give us more than what he knows, how are we going to get to these tools? My problem is that how are we going to get into it? Because the department will say that and the committee, we are not supposed to get the tools. The tool was supposed for us, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end of the day, you won't get the gist of what the movement is about in that tool and so on. This is why I'm trying to say, where are we? We are, this is as if we are in between. The tool knows, Mr. Munchen knows everything about the tool. The president knows everything about the tool.
Yeah.
We are in the middle. We don't know anything about the tool, but we want to get both sides. That's where I am.
No, I understand you. We're going to ask them nicely.
We don't know.
And if they refuse to give it to us, we'll cross the bridge when we get there. But we'll ask them nicely. If they then choose to say, no, it's not available, we'll cross it when we get there. But I'm sure we'll ask them nicely.
I think the point, sorry, Chair, is Mr. Munting, you should not enter into confidentiality agreements when you want to pass the transparency.
Yeah, no, that's also true. That's also true. You can't be confidential and then argue for transparency, but we understand what you were talking about. Let's move on to Mr. Munting, because now we've added the presentation by Nikro. So if you can do a similar thing, we'll also interrogate it to Ahmad for our meeting with the minister. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you.
I will just highlight a few things from the submission that was sent in. I think the first thing that when we are talking about the Jali Commission is that it has a long history. As early as 1996, this committee, Mr. Self may remember, expressed deep concern about what was happening in the Department of Correctional Services. And in fact, by 2000, this committee expressed concern that the state had indeed lost control over the Department of Correctional Services. So I think it's for us important to continue to go back to that question and ask, does the state have control over the Department of Correctional Services, or are there little islands within the department where the state is not controlling the department? In paragraph 3, we must also be reminded that the Jali Commission's terms of reference defined the problem in a very particular manner. It defined initially 6, later 9 management areas where it would focus on, where it would focus its investigations. So this is just a very small sample of the department's business. 9 out of more than 50 management areas that were looked at. Importantly, the head office was not specifically named in the commission's terms of reference, but the commission did, in a general way, investigate the head office, but still we did not see a chapter in the final report that specifically dealt with the head office. And I think recent events at the head office following the SIU's investigations has now proven that that was a significant weakness in the Commission's terms of reference. So, the original terms of reference are provided in paragraph 4. What I'll deal with is a description of corruption, a requirement of an effective response, but the bulk will deal of the submission will deal with a set of a limited number of core indicators aimed at assessing if the department has made headway in improving the situation in the prison system. And here I place the emphasis not so much on what the department has done to address problems, in other words, input indicators, but rather on what the results have been. In other words, we look at outcome indicators. So it's nearly 6 years since the final report was submitted, and probably close on 9 years since the first interim report was submitted to the department. So there's a considerable time lapse that have taken place, and it's therefore not unreasonable to expect some visible improvements based on the recommendations of the Jali Commission. I think we must be reminded that the Jali Commission was not entirely satisfied with the way in which the department had responded to its recommendations and concluded that the general attitude of members of the department to be self-defeating in that they believe that outsiders could not tell them how to run their prisons. And as a point was made earlier by Ms. Bariachi, that there's been all these investigations with all these recommendations and we still see very much the same problems year in and year out. So we must be vigilant when we assess how the department responds to recommendations. I move on to paragraph 8, and there's a very simple formula for how we can understand corruption. Corruption happens when officials have monopoly over something, they have discretion to use the authority, but there is no accountability. So for instance, around parole decisions, they've got the monopoly, they have the discretion, who holds them accountable? Can it be manipulated? That is the basic understanding of corruption. And I think we can refer to right violations where there is not accountability, when people are being assaulted, or there are even deaths in custody. So, at paragraph 11, if we then look at what an effective national anti-corruption strategy must aim to address, it emphasizes that this must be a holistic response and it not be narrow in its focus and application. And there are four key components. And the first one is prevention, the second one is law enforcement, thirdly public awareness, and fourthly institution building. The extent to which the department has been able to strike an appropriate balance between these four dimensions require closer scrutiny. At face value, it appears that much effort and energy has been invested in investigations as per the SIU and building capacity internally to conduct investigations such as the Departmental Investigations Unit, but it remains uncertain what efforts have been undertaken by the department to prevent corruption and human rights violations. Have there been extensive staff training and so forth? Have prisoners been informed of their rights and responsibilities? Is that being done on a consistent basis and so forth? I will now move on to the treatment of prisoners. This forms an important focus of the Commission's final report, and particularly the moral and physical integrity of prisoners. Despite these prescripts, the Commission found ample evidence of officials treating prisoners as if they had no rights. Now, I want to draw the Commission's attention to the events described in paragraph 30. And I think it's important that this mass assault took place in July 2005. This is the time when the Commission had nearly completed its work and a mass assault took place at St. Albans Prison. And it describes in detail what had happened there, and this has subsequently been reported to the UN Human Rights Committee. They have made a ruling on it and found that South Africa has violated the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights by violating Article 7, the absolute prohibition of torture. To my knowledge, no official has been held accountable in respect of this offence. I think one official was prosecuted but acquitted. So, if we then move on to paragraph 15, the most recent annual report details 55 unnatural deaths in prisons during the 2009 financial year. In 10 of these deaths, officials of the department were directly implicated. However, in none of these cases have there been any prosecutions at the time the report was published. Mr. Raga promises us a more updated annual report. In table 1 on that page, there is more detailed information, and I've done a calculation there to give the unnatural deaths per 10,000 of the prison population, and we see in 2004-05 it stood at 4 per 10,000, it then halved the next year, but doubled the following year, and it is still very much at the same level it was in 2004-05. So, if we're asking the question, is our prisoners safer now than what they were 5 years ago, based on this, we must say, no, not really. So if we look at the number of assaults per year, in paragraph 17, they are also represented in table 2 and figure 1 on the following, or my following page. We've seen a decline from 2004 towards 2007-08, where it dropped from 124 per 10,000 to 51.6, but then again increased the following year to 83 per 10,000 inmates. Now, it's a total number of assaults that were reported to the Department of Correctional Services. These are not the Judicial Inspectorate's figures. It's in that last year, 1,372 assaults, that nearly four a day every day of the year.
paragraph 18, unnatural death and assault are core indicators in respect of the personal safety of prisoners. In respect of both these indicators, the results are unconvincing, and it remains uncertain what steps the department has taken to make prisons safer and reduce the number of violent incidents. In this regard, specific attention should be paid to the training of staff and the actions taken by management to ensure a human rights-based approach to prison management. At paragraph 19, the UN Convention Against Torture in Article 10 requires that South Africa, and that's the Department of Correctional Services, shall ensure that education and information regarding the prohibition against torture are fully included in the training of law enforcement personnel, civil or military, medical, and so forth. I'm not going to read through that entire quote. It remained unknown whether the department has incorporated training on the absolute prohibition of torture and ill treatment into its basic and supplementary training, or whether the department has developed a policy on the prevention and eradication of torture. The lack of prosecutions, as reflected on earlier, foster a culture of impunity for the simple reason that it in effect communicates to officials that nothing will happen if prisoners' rights are violated. The utter lack of transparency in respect of rights violation, especially in respect of serious violations, is unacceptable and needs to be addressed as a matter of urgency. It therefore submitted that the department and the judicial inspectorate in their respective annual reports provide detailed information on the following: the number and nature of allegations of assault, the steps taken and progress to date in respect of investigating allegations of assault, the number and nature of alleged unnatural deaths in custody, the steps taken to investigate these deaths, and the steps taken to prevent and eradicate torture and ill treatment of all prisoners, with specific reference to Articles 10 to 14 of the UN Convention Against Torture. If we then turn to oversight and monitoring, and here I'll specifically look at the disciplinary process and draw the committee's attention essentially to Table 3 and Figure 2. And I'm not going to go through all the details. Figure 2 perhaps explains it best, where we see over the period 1997 to 2008-09 this seesawing figure in terms of disciplinary actions against DCS officials. If we look at that in a bit more detail, we'll see that those increases were usually linked with specific investigations, either by the Public Service Commission or the Department of Public Service and Administration, or the Jali Commission, or the SIU. And what is worrying about this is that there's not a sustained increase and level at which disciplinary actions are being maintained. And my interpretation of this is that disciplinary actions are very much investigation driven and not something that individual managers in the department take on as part of their job function in a sustained manner to ensure that the disciplinary code is enforced in a consistent and sustained manner, because these ups and downs create, I think, misguidance for the junior rank and file about how discipline is enforced in the department. So, the seesawing figure may reflect an attitude by the department management, or even a decision that the SIU and the DIU will take care of discipline. If this is indeed the case, it is extremely unfortunate. The two investigating units are there to support the department with specialist skills and knowledge and to provide comprehensive forensic solutions, but they do not replace the day-to-day duty of every manager in the department to enforce the disciplinary code and promote good performance. Enforcement of the disciplinary code by every operational manager also lends sustainability to the achievements of the investigations in addressing corruption, maladministration, and rights violations by making compliance with prescripts and codes part of organizational culture. At paragraph 24, reporting on the investigation of corruption in the department has been scant, and the most comprehensive report remains that of the Jali Commission.
Even the SIU reports are only provide cursory details, leaving many questions unanswered as to the exact facts of the cases handled. Apart from holding offenders accountable, investigations into corruption should contribute to the broader process of prevention in a number of ways. And three proposals are made there. Investigations should contribute to knowledge building by improving understanding of how a particular crime was committed, how it was detected, and what effect it had, and indicate systemic weaknesses. Investigations should inform the risk assessment with reference to type of risk and the extent of the risk. The results of investigations, successful or not, should be made available to stakeholders from government or civil society with the aim to improve insight into the problem and demonstrate that effective action can and will be taken against corrupt officials. At paragraph 25, on the 20th of March this year, City Press reported that the SIU submitted its report on investigating large tender contracts to the Minister of Correctional Services in September 2009. The report makes a number of serious allegations, amongst which are listed there, that the department, under the previous commissioner, MT, used savings from the fund for the compensation of prison staff to pay for the Basasa tenders, that the previous chief financial officer received cash, cars, kitchen, and payments towards a house from Basasa, that the same official carried business cards indicating he was a consultant to a Basasa affiliate while he was working for the department, that the company Basasa was involved in drafting tender documents for contracts it won in a way that gave it a clear advantage in the awarding of these tenders, and lastly, that the SIU concluded that there was an improper and corrupt relationship between Gillingham MT and the Basasa group of companies. It has now been nearly 2 years since the SIU report was submitted to the Minister of Correctional Services, and as far as could be established, no action has been taken to criminally prosecute the implicated officials. If my information is correct and there's more up-to-date information available, and there has indeed been progress in these prosecutions, I will gladly change the position here. The efforts of the Jali Commission to rid the Department of Corruption will amount to little if the findings of the SIU investigations are not used to call officials to account. In a matter as serious as this, it is not within the discretion of the Minister to decide whether a criminal prosecution will indeed take place. In this regard, the committee's attention is drawn to Section 34 of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act. And there, and I'm not going to read the whole quote, but a person who holds a position of authority and knows or ought reasonably to have known or suspected that any person has committed an offence must report that if it's in excess of 100,000 rand. And that person who is in a position of authority includes the Commissioner of Correctional Services, with whom this responsibility now rests. The findings of the SIU are serious not only because of the amount of money involved, but because it is head office staff indicated. Moreover, the alleged crimes took place in the immediate aftermath of the Jali Commission submitting its final report. By way of conclusion, the Commission made numerous and detailed recommendations to the Department, and these need to be actively monitored. Unless it has been communicated otherwise, it remains unknown which of the recommendations made by the Commission has been accepted by the Department and which have not. There may indeed be valid reasons why certain recommendations have not been accepted. But this needs to be communicated to Parliament and to the public. It should further be noted that the Commission was not satisfied with the Department's response to the 8th, 9th, 10th and 11th interim reports, which were submitted to the Department in February 2004. The Commission found that the Department had failed to fulfill its recommendations because members who were guilty of criminal offences had not been disciplined and continued to be employed by the Department under the protection of senior officials. Much attention has in recent years been paid to investigating grand corruption cases in the department, such as those investigated by the SIU. While this is crucially important, petty corruption affecting the daily lives of prisoners remain apparently neglected. It is equally important that rights violations against prisoners are properly investigated, but also that the necessary actions be implemented by the DCS to prevent violations, In this regard, the inspectorate should play a proactive role. The above submission raised a number of issues aimed at assessing the performance of the department according to a number of core indicators. This is not an exhaustive list and needs to be expanded on. Nonetheless, the crucial issue remains: the Commission's recommendations require active monitoring and continued debate. I've added a few things based on the discussion so far, and perhaps just to reiterate some of the things said. I think it is important that the department gets the basics right, that in all our prisons, the prisoners are detained under conditions that meet the minimum standards of humane detention, that there is compliance with the Correctional Services Act, and this requires a human rights-based approach to prison management. I think, secondly, the department should stop distracting itself with issues that are, in our view, not part of its core business. The name changes of prisoners, the establishment of halfway houses, the high-tech security solutions, they all distract the department from its core business, namely detaining people under humane conditions. And thirdly, as said earlier, it's important that the Department of Correctional Services senior management publicize what happens to the officials who perpetrate acts of corruption and violate prisoners' rights. It's only by publicizing those examples that the message will go through to the junior rank and file that this type of illegal behavior will not be tolerated by senior management. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Let me make, because I was the last to speak the last time, can I be the first to make comments and you can respond when you respond to others? Mr. Lucas, I'm always intrigued by what you said at the end, that the core function of the department is the humane detention. Now, I thought we had moved away from detention to reintegration and rehab. That's what I thought, but it's not the first time I've heard you talking about detention and distracting. And it's just a comment that I'm making, because I think it's all inclusive, quite honestly. It's not just the humane detention, and you get out of there after 10 years and you'll come back tomorrow, because that's what we pick up on the ground, because there's been no preparation for re-entry into society. But, you know, and this is just from my side, and I'm raising it with Mom Gwenya, Mr. Self, and others that have been here longer than I've been in this department. Mr. Lucas says the Dali Commission's major concern was whether the state was in control, or the department was in control, or the state was in control of this department. He raises it as a major concern. What does this committee do, or somebody? They go and privatize some of these centers. It just doesn't make sense to me. That if you are saying you're worried whether the state is in control, and then you go and privatize, I don't understand, and I'm not saying it's the committee's point of view, but I'm saying, Mr. Munting, it can't be both. Because just now you were saying, let us learn from the PPPs. Here the commission, the Dali Commission says, my major concern is whether the South African state is in control. Mangaung and Limpopo, we have no control other than a junior somebody sitting there. So that's what I'm raising. Also, you raised the issue around corruption is equal to monopoly. And I'm just raising it as a department. I do think that as a committee, we're going to sit one day and talk about the politics of this department. You raised the issue around corruption drives in monopoly. And you raised the issue about the parole board. And the rationale at the time was that these parole boards were members of the department, and therefore they were able to monopolize and make corruption. What do? We go and make them independent. We don't even know who these people are that are chairing the parole board. We don't know who they are, but just because of this pressure that it must be transparent, we take it out of the department, we give it to people, we don't know them up. We don't know them. And the end result, Mr. Munti, is that if you go to the Eastern Cape, across the road, this parole board gives you parole, that one doesn't give you parole. You know what is happening? People that are arrested in St. Albans,
one asks for a transfer somewhere else because he knows he's going to get it there.
Mm-hmm.
So I am just saying that this department, this committee, up to now, and I'm going to raise it with them, I just think the way we were doing things in the past just doesn't make sense. And I know that hindsight is good, but these are the things that I think we must discuss politically around all these things. Because if the Dalit Commission raised them, then civil society must do what it needs to do, the department must do what they need to do, we need to do what we need to do. It's not a departmental problem only. So I'm just raising those two issues, Mr. Munting, and when you respond, you can respond to them. And I'm just raising them because I do think that we must really engage in a serious discussion with the department if we want to change these things. Just on your last one or two around the SIU findings, and Vinamuzi and Mamela, you guys will be expected to confirm it. My understanding was the department has done or started doing what it can do internally, and others it has referred to the NPA. I think that is my understanding, but you'll come and confirm it, because we agree with Mr. Munting that if the SIU has made certain recommendations, we must be seen to be implementing them, whether they're internally or externally. But my understanding was that those that were of a criminal nature have been referred to the NPA, and if that indeed is the case, then of course we would need to follow that one up, just to answer on that one. And then I think it's page 7, your chapter 22, I think, or 21, the one that Mr. Munting that you spoke about was yes, around humane detention or something like that. I'll tell you, 21, the one of humane detention. I think the inspecting judge, now that you're going to come and account to us quarterly, if you can look at those steps and whatever else, when you come to account to us, you must be able to say to us, these are the things you're going to report upon. So we are able to follow it up with you and whoever. There's that A to E. If you can just indicate to us if you are going to cover or already are covering that A to E, so that we can hold the department accountable to that one. And the final point that I want to make overall, I was sobered, Mr. Self. I think it was his albums or Amtata. When we met with the officials afterwards, not senior officials, but the officials on the ground. You know, there was a lady, an elderly lady, that said to us, you know, Chairperson, you guys come and do oversight, and all you care about is our treatment to officials, our treatment to inmates. None of you ever worry about how inmates treat us. These guys get parole, they finish their term. Mina, I'm working here for 40 years. For 24 hours, I'm on duty. Because when I leave, I go back to the society where these inmates come from, whose family are. So I do think, and I said I will make it my mission, certainly, personally, that we need to balance the abuses of power, or whatever you want to call it, from officials to inmates. But I think similarly, we also need to understand that inmates also have a certain amount of influence and abuse that they have on our officials. And it's not an easy environment in which to work. I said I must put it on the table so that it's balanced. People must begin to understand that as this committee, we're concerned about the officials' well-being as much as we are concerned about the inmates' well-being. And it's not a one-way process. And we'll continue to preach that gospel wherever we go. So now that the public are here, I hope you're capturing it in the spirit in which we are raising it. That it's not just about official abuse, but it's also about ensuring that our officials operate in a condition that you and I would want to operate in every day when we go to work. So those were just opening remarks around your one, Mr. Munting. We don't have to respond to them. We'll then allow members to get into them in detail, and we'll do as we did at the first one. I note Mr. Self, and after Mr. Self, we'll take Advocate, and then Mamgwet. Mr. Self, sir.
Yes, thank you. I hope you can hear me.
Yeah.
Chair, yes, it indeed exactly relates to the point you just made. The Monty presentation finished, the formal presentation finished, with assessing performance indicators, and he suggested a number of core indicators, self, death, and disciplinary action. I made the marginal note, what others? And I made it within the context of the fact that if I was the devil's advocate in this thing, I would also say that actually there's a power relationship that exists in most prisons that I'm aware of between organized gangs and an institution called the DCA. And that it's very, very easy if one's going down the track of looking at particular indicators, of ignoring the indicators on the other side, like the very important one of assault by inmates on officials, which might also be underreported. And indeed, reported incidents of attempted assault by inmates on officials, for example. Because I think that if you do that, you will point out another very important thing, and that is the extent to which there is a functioning intelligence service within any correctional centre that allows one to anticipate problems and deal with them proactively, which is what we expect prison management to do. Now, the other OCU, the chairperson has dealt with the issue of the SIU report, which is what I wanted to raise. But the other thing is that getting the basics right now, and making sure that people are kept in humane circumstances. Now, you know as well as I do that there are a lot of correctional centres, particularly ones near the major centres, that are forced to take the people that they are sent. And it's very, very difficult in some circumstances to keep people in humane conditions when overcrowding rates are at the extent that they are. Now, I just like the comment on about by Mr. Munting on what if you were the prison, if you were the head of centre in Johannesburg, Medium B, what do you do in a practical sense to ensure that you get the basics right when you are when every single day there are another five trucks coming from the court with more people that you've got to accommodate, either as remand detainees or as sentenced prisoners. What is needed as a management tool to allow the head of centre to fulfil that responsibility?
Thank you. Mr. Munting, you have the first right, and your colleagues can add if they want to add, and we'll see where we are.
Okay. Can I start with Mr. Self?
Anyway.
Okay. On your first question, Mr. Self, these are examples of indicators. Just given the time constraints for preparing the submission, I looked at these few. I think ultimately one must look at it in a comprehensive manner, and we must be guided by what the Act requires from the Department. That is what must govern its operations, and that is how we must assess its performance. Is it implementing the Correctional Services Act, or is it keeping itself busy with other things? So, in terms of your scenario, Johannesburg prison, which we know is severely overcrowded, what must the manager do? I think there are some things that the manager can do. But the problem with particularly awaiting trial people is something that extends beyond correctional services, but that is what the cluster must look at. If we know, and the research backs me up, that 50% of people who are in custody today, their cases will be withdrawn, they will not go to trial. By filtering out those cases, we can roughly reduce our awaiting trial population by 25,000 in a very short space of time. Similarly, just on the numbers issue, our sentenced admissions have dropped by 50% over the last 5 years. We are sending fewer and fewer people to prison, which is a good and a bad thing, because it means that our criminal justice system is virtually collapsing. How can we have such a reduction when
other hand, it does provide the Department of Correctional Services with a bit of a breather to develop the systems and procedures that it needs to develop in order to implement the Correctional Services Act properly at all 240 prisons. The solution lies at an intersectoral level between justice and police in terms of alleviating the overcrowding situation. There are other practical steps that one can also look at. I'm not discounting prison construction, renovating facilities. Those are all things that the department has been trying to do, some more successful than others, since 1994. Mr. Smith, you noted that I again emphasize humane detention. I think humane detention is a prerequisite for achieving the higher, loftier ideals of reintegration, rehabilitation. It's very difficult to tell offenders that they must become law-abiding citizens, yet they are being assaulted by officials, they are being raped inside themselves by other prisoners, they have to pay bribes to get access to the most basic services, they've got to pay a cool drink or a 10 rand to get an extra blanket in winter. Then it is very difficult to tell them be law-abiding citizens, because they regard very often the officials as a crook in a different uniform. So in terms of the question of whether the state is in control, it was the question posed by this committee, and just to clarify it somewhat, when corruption flourishes in an organization, they develop what the researchers call calm biopes. These are areas that corrupt officials control. Nobody disturbs it. And it's these criminal factions within organizations that are responsible for grand and pervasive corruption. And that is what happened in the Department of Correctional Services, and that is what the Jolly Commission looked at, especially in terms of human resources management and the appointment of staff. Mr. Smith, I agree with the question, how do inmates treat officials? But it is also the case that it's a two-way process. If prisoners are treated with respect, if their issues are taken seriously, if they are listened to, then the potential for violence is significantly reduced. There's been extensive research on this in the UK. I've done my own research here. And ex-prisoners will very clearly describe what a good warder is. They say it is a person who listens, who takes the issues seriously. And then you have a prison that is healthy, that is not characterized by violence and corruption. But we know that there are prisons who do not meet these requirements, and they suffer from violence and attacks on officials. I would like to add a question to that, and say, but how does the junior officials, the rank and file staff, how are they being treated by the senior management? They are very often marginalized, and their issues are ignored. We did our research on how HIV and AIDS is treated or managed in the department. And the stories we heard were hair-raising about how officials are being marginalized if they are HIV positive, the extent to which they are supported by the senior management. So there's in my assessment, there's a huge distance between the junior staff and the staff sitting at regional or head office level, which makes it extremely difficult for the head office to implement any change and transformation processes, because they fundamentally lack legitimacy in the eyes of the junior officials. I'll stop there. Thank you.
This is the part
Very briefly.
I think Mr. Winding has talked a lot about the issue of humane detention, and Mr. Duff, you asked the question. What does a head of center, what is the basic that a head of center has to do? And what I've just been thinking about is, we've really complicated the issue of rehabilitation and reintegration. who set the department has lots of strategic objectives, really manages and heads the centers are running around doing a whole range of things. Linked to the institutional culture and all of that, what is needed is to create a correctional environment that basically espouses the values of respect, dignity, and integrity. And if they bore that in mind as a leader in terms of that's what my correctional center is going to be, that's the environment I want to create in this correctional center. I know it sounds idealistic, but like with Mr. Munting, I think we've always supported and we work with rehabilitation. So we know, unless you model it, unless you teach what it is to have, treat other people with dignity and respect, you're not going to have it. So it does require every single correctional official to be able to live that. It's not about just training a person in the Constitution and human rights. And sadly in this country, we boast the values of human rights, but as a society, we do not live it. And that's what it requires officials to live the Constitution, to live what we say in terms of our democracy. And so once you get the basic rights, simple things that we have to remember. Respect, listen, as Mr. Munting said, you know, in the actual officials. It's about people at the end of the day. And if we can get the people issues right, then I think all the other issues will fall into place. So that's the simple solution, but this will take.
That's fine. One day you guys are going to come and talk to us about the issues that Mr. Sal Glazes about, the culture of gangsterism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about human rights and all those things that officials must give, but where I live and grew up, it's the epicenter of gangsterism in South Africa, Western. All the guys are from there. So, you know, it's very difficult for these guys that are officials to have a humane outlook when the very people they're looking after have no concept about human rights type of thing. For them, your progress is by spilling blood. And if you spill blood of somebody in the brown uniform, it's even better. So, Anas, my daughter, if we are saying that I go to work knowing that I'm a target, if I'm still going to worry whether you had a slice of bread yesterday, knowing Guti, you, the 20... I'm just saying we must have that discussion. Gwena Muzi, I know that that's your key portfolio now. I think we must have this discussion at some point. Advocate Lex, and then Mam Gwenya, and then you'll follow Mabyanda.
Thanks. I will be quick, Chair. Thank you so much for that input. Mr. Munting, I really appreciate really your input every time when you make input to this conference. But as much as I know and you know that it is not the flip side of a coin to address this issue, as long as there's a commitment. On the issue of assault, did you only count all the complaints per se, or was there some sort of a survey about justified assault, like justified murder, in self-defense, that type of thing? And whether the official was acquitted, and do you still add those where he was not found guilty of any violation per se, but under justifiable circumstances? Is that part of your thing, or is there some sort of a certain process? The other one.
We'll come back to your second one.
Okay.
Mr. Max, these are the figures reported in the annual reports of the Department of Correctional Services. And they have also in recent years, combined all the figures. So we don't actually see whether it's inmate on inmate, official on inmate. The general sense is that what I'm trying to say is that our prisons are not safe. The state cannot guarantee my safety if I am in prison tonight.
Mm.
The next one, Chair, very quickly. With regard,
I do think that whilst I'm agreeing with you, I'm saying this because really, ladies and gentlemen, you know, Mr. Munting, you probably have reasons to say what you're saying, but I don't want that thing to go out as if it's a committee position, because you know we are busy fighting the Diwani case as we speak.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying that, I'm not taking away what you are saying, but really, I'm asking for responsible journalism from the journalists. And I'll tell you why I'm saying this. And not to you, Mr. Munting. I'm talking to the journalists now. On the 10th, we were in a conference at that when this decision was taken that Juwani can come to South Africa and go through whatever he needs to go through. Before we emerged for lunch, a journalist tweeted, whatever his name is, Juwani, whatever your name is, Papa is waiting for you. This is what the journalist said before we came out for lunch. So I'm appealing to journalists to when you do this reporting, that you report it in such a way that you do not undo what we struggled to do in the last couple of weeks. That's all that I wanted to say, but I'm not taking away what you've been saying. But respond, I think I stopped you before you had concluded your response to Mr. Nash, so I'm allowing you to continue.
No, I have concluded, but I do want to pick up on the gangs issue. I think it is a debate that must be had. But if we ask the question, why do gangs exist in prisons? They are there. People join gangs in order to be protected. That is why they do it, because they feel essentially unsafe. In prisons where people are adequately protected, where they feel safe, where they are not deprived of basic necessities, they are kept busy, and so forth. There we don't find gangs to be so prevalent. Now, I've visited a number of prisons in the last couple of months and seen evidence of this. I've also seen in prisons where the officials are very strict, where they say no gang activities will be allowed here, and you check it with the prisoners, and they confirm it. So it is not a problem that we cannot manage and we cannot overcome. It can be done. But it is, again, it comes back to a management approach that relies on respecting the rights of prisoners. Because if it does not happen, then you have the situation of us versus them. And if we see in the initiation rituals of the 26th and the 28th, they use the officials to beat up their prospective members as part of a ritual. As long as the officials keep on beating the prisoners, then there will be gangs, because they have to go through that.
Mr. Beck, your partner.
Chair. You know, we don't have time to debate certain things with Mr. Munting. But, you know, I was at St. Albans, and one of these officials, young men, just requested one of the inmates to move over. You know, he provoked this guy. They fucked you, man. You know? So, that's why, let's debate this out. It's not to say that they are angels in this, correct that they have been assaulted, but it's reciprocal of nature. The other thing is your discipline. Your finding or your views with regards to the implementation of discipline in the organization or the department, is it based on a study which you conducted in the department? Because my information is that they've got a national disciplinary code enforcement team on a national level. And if that is the case and it's not being cascaded down for the delegation of powers to managers at grassroots level to implement, then they take responsibility. But as long as they know it is being done from head office, they don't take responsibility. So in terms of the LRA, something which has to be managed within the workplace. So I just want to know whether it is based on that so that we can take it up with the CCA.
The figures I use here are from the annual reports. That is how they are reflected there. They don't give a breakdown as to who initiated, but I think you're putting your finger on the problem. It is something, and that's my interpretation, it's something that is done by that code enforcement team. It's the result of DIU and SIU investigation. It does not, as it does now, place that responsibility on every single head of prison and unit manager and so on and so say, you are responsible for maintaining discipline of your staff and to see that they perform their job properly. Because it's not only about transgressing rules, it's also about good performance.
Thank you. Mangonia? Time is going to catch up with us. I'm asking you to be brief and put in the responses, otherwise, you have to make it to Nico.
Thank you, Shepherdson. I'll be brief. Mine is a clarity on page 45 on what you said to address the issue of overcrowding. The commission investigated the incarceration of awaiting fire and sentence prison and found generally that awaiting fire prison should be incarcerated close to their own. I wanted to understand that when you look at the overcrowding on awaiting fire, is only this problem that we have found in terms of the people that need to be next to their home. And I want to share with you and in our oversight visit that we have observed that overcrowding is done by the people that are sitting in the cell with the bail of 300 rand for 6 months or more than 6 months. And when you look at the budget that they spend inside in the center, they spend 3,000 a month. And I want to know from you, what is your view in terms of that when the person is, the bail is 300 rand for 6 months, but inside is going to spend 3,000 a month. How are you going to assist the Department of Correctional Service in terms of saving this money than paying this 3,000 a month for a person on a day, 300? Thank you.
Thank you, Mangwenya. As the Criminal Procedure Act stands now, it's our assessment that it does not protect the right to liberty in an adequate manner. Now, in the example you give of a person sitting in custody for a month on 300 rand bail, in this particular case, unaffordable bail, surely we must look at a mechanism whereby the head of prison and there should rest an obligation on that head of prison to say, I've got somebody here, he appeared now twice, he can't afford the bail, I must take him back and speak to the court. My recollection, I didn't check now, but my recollection is that there's already such a mechanism in the Act through the latest amendments, but also previously as well. So, yes, I am quite sure heads of centres can do a lot more to bring those type of cases to the attention of the courts, because if 300 rand bail has been granted, the court did not regard that person as a serious flight risk, nor a serious risk to interfere with witnesses or evidence, and rated their chances of appearing actually quite high. So, yeah, we must specifically look at those cases.
No, I'm not thinking about that one. Are you on this one or on new one? I'm not sure, but is it on the bail? Okay, then we'll come to you, sir. Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to raise this thing of gangsterism and inmates, I mean, and the officials. In some centers, last weekend in Barrington, 28th and 26th, they were fighting inside themselves. Officially also come and assist some of the inmates in the two groups, those who were fighting, and they kept each other, and the inmates, two of them are admitted to the one of them, I think it's the 28th, they end up saying he must be transferred. He's in constant as a prisoner. You don't understand, because these inmates and officials, some of the officials are 26 and 28. Some of the inmates are 26 and 28. You don't know who's calling who between these two. I think in Barbican, the one time they had this problem, but we never had 26 and 28. It has started now. It has started. I don't know how did it come around. I was just saying, Chairperson, we must look both sides. Yeah. Officials. Some of them, they even have tattoos. Officials. Thank you, Chairperson.
Well, we have to comment. We'll discuss the food phenomenon at some point in the future around that one. Very near future. But Baba Joe.
Chairperson, I wanted to ask, because that when we look at the recommendation of the commission report, do you think they have been implemented, they have been implemented? If the answer is yes, can you then, if the answer is yes, can you then quote where the problem is, if they are not implemented? The second question, which arises out of the recommendation, the kitchen service. In other areas, it's recommended that it should be outsourced. And it's outsourced to somebody else. And the department is paying a lot of money out of that outsourcing. But in other areas, it's not outsourced. The inmates are doing it themselves. Do you think that the department is shooting the foot by doing so? I'm asking this question, Chairperson, because if the FIU have come up with a recommendation and there is no time frame to implement that, how far are we to go? And all these people that have been blamed by the ICU will die tomorrow. And they're not clever.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Ndlovu, I think you raised the most difficult question. We don't know what has been, and I'm saying we from civil society, from academia, don't know what has been implemented in terms of the Jali Commission's recommendations. The previous minister said to this committee 60% of the recommendations were implemented. We don't know which 60%. So the easy ones or the difficult ones? I don't know. We will have to go back and go through each and every single recommendation. That report is 1,800 pages long. In terms of the kitchen service, I made a submission, I think it was last year, where I raised this as an issue of concern, because the companies that are providing the privately operated kitchens, they are using prisoners to do the work. There's maybe an outside person as a supervisor from the company. So essentially they are making profits by using prison labor. Yet those prisoners are not afforded the same protection under the labor laws. So what happens is that person breaks his neck on a wet floor and is paralyzed for the rest of his life. That's one issue. There's also an ethical issue around using prison labor to make profit. If other prisoners who are working in the kitchens for these private companies, are they getting paid extra money? Or do they get the same gratuity? I think it raises a lot of issues that I'm personally concerned about. I can't see exactly what is the justification for outsourced kitchens. This is something that is done in a few prisons, and not in all the prisons. So why is it working in some prisons and not in others? It sounds to me more like a management problem than anything else.
Vincent Bakaguli.
I have a question on this.
All right, before you continue, Bakaguli, you want to...
Chairperson, I take note that their department has apparently said that 60% of the recommendations have been implemented. Now, we are aware that rape and sodomy takes place in prisons. In your interactions, I think Jali recommended that there must be some form of sensitivity on the part of the officials in dealing with the survivors of these deeds, and that they should be assisted. In your view, or from your research, do you find that this is happening? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Abram. I know that the department has established or implemented a post-exposure prophylaxis protocol. So if a victim comes forward, if they've been raped, they can get access to post-exposure prophylaxis. And then I learned recently that the department has developed a policy framework on the prevention of sexual victimization in prisons. So I think that's a step in the right direction, and I by no means want to discourage it. But this is a long-standing problem. Why do we have to wait until 2011 before we see some movement on this? One is left with a sense that it's not being taken seriously always. Thank you.
The Honorable Makaku.
Thank you, Chair. My question was first, Mr. Nyandav has already seen some of my question. I was want to ask that are you aware that there was an official that are involved in Kelsta prison? Is what Mr. Nyandav said. The other things that I want to ask is this one of the sexual violence. I just wanted to ask that, do you know any of the mechanisms in place to prevent this sexual violence? Because now we have some gays and Libyans. As we were visiting the correctional centers, we find two gays in one of the prospects. So what will happen if they be charged? Because now they are not charged. If they be charged, what will be happening? They will be put to the males or they will be put to the females. What will happen? Because they come there as a woman and it's promoting the sexual activities at the prison. I think.
Interesting question. I think we must, in terms of sexual violence and the prevention of sexual violence, we must start off with the Sexual Offences Act and ensure that DCS officials are well versed in the Act. I've recently come across a case where it was known that a rape had taken place, but there was no prosecution following from that. I'm not too sure that the department has developed the necessary training materials for their staff to deal with cases of sexual victimization in terms of the Sexual Offences Act. If I heard the question correctly, it was about transgender people. I think these are cases that must be assessed on a case-by-case basis. Ultimately, we must be guided by the duty placed on us by the Constitution, is to preserve the dignity of the individual, and that is what must ultimately determine what must happen there. So it's very difficult for me to see which section the person will go to. It will depend on the requirements there to ensure their safe custody.
We will give you the first bite next time. We'll allow you to wrap it up. This time is really a game.
What
should I do? Continue until we can't allow you to continue.
Human dignity and humane detention, and I think the opening quote says it all. No one truly knows a nation until it has been inside its jails, and that was said by Nelson Mandela. And they say a nation should not be judged by how it treats its highest citizens, but its lowest citizens. And that's the motivation for why the whole respect for human dignity is based on and how we can change our society. Because I know, Chairperson, you mentioned the whole issue of gangsterism, but offending behavior and getting caught up in gangsterism has root causes to it. There's fundamentally no foundational stuff missing in people's lives. And the Department of Correctional Services has this very important opportunity to play a significant other in a person's life. They can really show enough interest to try and see if there's a possibility that people can change. We know that inmates are manipulative, yes. They do have a lot of... they're complex to handle, we know as well. But, I mean, based on lots of research about rehabilitation, this is how it works with us. We've seen changes in people. And so I'm just hoping that that would transfer to the Department of Correctional Services. So anyway, the Jali Commission, I'm not going to go into all the details there. You said you don't want to know what the Jali Commission highlighted, but it did expose a lot of complex challenges. I think they're not just superficial. They still require a lot of debate. The challenges by recommendations outlined, yes, need to be thoroughly interrogated. And what took me so long last week working on this was to read that report. Not knowing, I mean, Lucas had a summary on it, but I think I just wanted to go through the details. And what I had first done was I tried to put all the recommendations into a table, and it came to 60 pages back to back, because I thought it would be useful to go and develop this kind of checklist on it. And hopefully, I don't know, Paul, if that's something that we could do as a committee with regard to recommendations from various investigations, so that you have a monitoring tool that you can use to monitor recommendations, debate key issues, get the department to respond. If we haven't implemented it, why haven't we implemented it? What is the complexity to implementing it and not just leave it? So I think there's merit in those commission recommendations, and hopefully we'll get through each and every one of them. Of very serious concern, obviously, Jali highlighted was the issue of gross violation of human rights of inmates. But I know, as we said, a lot of these issues we've been deliberating in these committee meetings, and from 2006 and even before, these issues remain. And we haven't made major improvements in issues of overcrowding, for example, the gang situation. Poor management. Management still remains an issue. Treatment of prisons, sexual violence in prison, abuse of power, and misconduct. I don't think we have made too many inroads with regard to that. But just with regard to the issue on page 3 around institutional culture, I mean, we've talked about the recommendations from Jali was to look at training. But like we've mentioned, it's beyond just training. It's changing the mindset, changing the correctional environment. And that requires, as the ISS pointed out, the whole change management approach. But with regard to management issues, I think we've talked about them quite extensively in this committee, and it's come up time and time again that there is a lack of synergy between the white paper and what actually happens on the operational day-to-day. And I think that's why the white paper is coming up for review in terms of, is it the practical policy to implement? So whereas the vision of the white paper was to move away from a militaristic approach to a human rights approach into the management, we know that a culture of human rights does not exist. Key issues highlighted by Jali, however, which is important, is the lack of visionary leadership, for example, in under-management issues. And I think that's an important issue. For the last while, I know it was mentioned, the whole issue on instability, around management, we've had so many commissioners, and I think that has contributed in a negative way to how this department is led, what its policies, what the priorities are, because things probably change all the time. And I think there has to be some stability in this department, and hopefully that will happen for the next while. But it's something obviously we can't control. But with recruitment, I think you're looking for a certain type of person as a leader. And leadership, there's just certain vision that we need. So we need to get the right people to work in this department. Okay, the communication was an issue that was picked up between senior management and members on the ground. Issues of poor record keeping, and I know in a last year's audit report that came up again. So hopefully the department will report on how those issues have improved. I don't know if this was attended to, but it said that the department's attendance register could not be relied on. And that's an issue. I don't know how it is now at different centres where there is attendance register that's up to date and kept updated. My core of the presentation focused a lot on the gang issue and sexual violence in prison. So I'm going to talk mainly to those particular issues and treatment of prisoners. With regard to the gangs, we know it's a big problem. It's a huge issue. There's victimization happening. There's gangs where they say are ruling prisons. There's a gang code. There's, a whole lot of corruption, drug smuggling, a whole range of things linked to gang activity. It is a serious problem. But what concerns me is that the last time that it was reported to this committee, I think it was last year in May, around the gang management strategy. This is what Jali recommended. But apparently the department does not have a gang management strategy. Jali recommended an in-depth research report to look at the issue of gang culture in South Africa. And although there has been research done by CSBR many years ago, that's why Jali also recommended link to those research organizations that have done work on gangs. We have anecdotal information around it, but we don't know what we're dealing with exactly, the complexity of the one in South Africa. And I really think Ms. Shaila, in that minutes of the last meeting that she presented to the committee, said that there was no need to have a dedicated gang management strategy, that it was incorporated into security objectives. But I don't think that's good enough. It was contradicted by the minister who said in a budget speech this year that the chief officer, there was a chief security officer or something, he would be responsible to review an anti-gang strategy. Now, if we don't have a strategy, how are we reviewing a strategy? And I think it's a serious enough issue to require a dedicated focus. And prisons around the world have dealt with this issue of gangs. And as Mr. Munting has said, it's in some prisons it's manageable. So we have to look at what, also in terms of good practice, that's what the research would show. What's working in some prisons? What have head of centers implemented in some prisons that others could try in others? Is this practice, good practice, being shared? Because there's variations around management within the DCS. So I think that's what we need to look at, and I really think it needs a research focus and a proper strategy, as well as then to report to this committee as to how far is the department proceeding or progressing with the gang issue. I mean, maybe people should start talking about, I don't ever hear people come to the department coming to talk about necessarily good practice in terms of management practices that have worked in, around these critical issues like overcrowding, gang, sexual violence.
They do.
They do.
We do.
Well, we should have more of that. Okay. Then, with regard to the issue of sexual violence, I think the issue of secrecy is still an issue in the department. I mean, just hearing now the committee members and their reaction in terms of a response to sexual violence happening in prison, and also an understanding around the Jali Commission highlights issues of homophobia and all of those kinds of things. But I think we sometimes misunderstand the context of sexual violence in prisons. Doesn't necessarily mean in all instances, and I may be mistaken, if it's an issue of when men are sodomized and that they become transgendered or anything. It's a completely unique phenomenon. It's not like a phenomenon of male rape is unique, and rape in prison is a particular phenomenon around power and control and a whole lot of other issues with regard to gang code. So we need to also understand that. I'm glad to hear that the department has a draft policy framework. And just to highlight that, Lucas, in the roundtable that was held recently with the CSPRI and CBSBR, I just want to highlight what they proposed to focus on. The draft policy framework on sexual abuse strategies included staff screening, where they were going to look at recruiting people, the right staff that wouldn't also abuse inmates sexually. They were looking at staff training around inmate rights, inmate orientation, especially coming into prison, that they become aware of what happens in prison, the dangers, how the gangs, you know, work, and vulnerability to all of that. And we know now with the Correctional Services Amendment Act, the issue of assessing for vulnerability to sexual exploitation and abuse has been put in. But now we have to see how we're going to implement that effectively. There was inmate classification issues. And then they talked about maintaining inmate safety through adequate staffing and supervision, and the establishment, then I think, of a sexual abuse database. Okay, sorry that I'm all over the place. I'm trying to just pull out some of the key issues. With regard to the overcrowding issue, I think the major issue that comes up from there is the use of correctional supervision. And I think I mentioned it the last time. There was meant, the Jali Commission recommends a survey be done of all people in prisons that are liable to qualify for correctional supervision. And I don't know if that audit has been done by the department. Because once they know, well, you know, this is the amount of people that can qualify for that, then the minister has to look at processing those applications. And I don't know how far the department is with regard to that. But that could, Jali believes that that could significantly improve overcrowding issues. But the overcrowding issue, once again, is a cluster issue. And it comes back to a recommendation around the committee to engage much more with the cluster, because there are some issues that we cannot just hold the DCS accountable for, and overcrowding is one of them. In past submissions, we also raised the whole issue, especially now around affordable bail. It supports that, you know, hands that down in terms of inmates. And so the whole sentencing regime has to be reviewed. We've talked a lot about how imprisonment should clear. It has to be an entire focus of the criminal justice system that says imprisonment is a last resort. Awaiting trial should be a last resort. And what are all the other options we can exhaust before we even get to that? And as much as there has been a significant shift in the use of diversion and non-custodial sentencing, we as NICRO, we find that still there's hesitancy by the magistracy and judiciary towards the use of this option. And we know it's not easy, because you get a whole public who wants a person to be put into prison and the key to be thrown away. There's high emotions with the public, and it's understandable. But that is not solving our issue of violent crime in this country. And so that's why public education is important. And what Jali did was raise the public's awareness of what's happening in prison. And it has made the public and a certain sector to think a bit more that maybe, yes, in some cases, imprisonment is not always the option, and that they become more responsive to non-custodial options and even be participative. Because remember, community control is a sanction. Where you have community in a restorative setup, if you have an offender and you have imposed a non-custodial approach or a restorative approach, community plays a valid role, an important role in enforcing some sort of control within that community when it comes to an offender. So these are all kinds of strategies that could really shift, but it requires a mind shift with regard to how we look at justice in this country and move from a punitive system to a more restorative system. Okay, then with regard to... There was another proposal with regard to the transfer of offenders and the treatment of offenders, where the Jali Commission motivated that to deal with the overcrowding issue, offenders should be transferred to prisons where they are less and overcrowded, where overcrowding is less of an issue. Then it raises the whole issue around then inmates are being transferred to other outlying prisons far away from their families. And I know the committee has always been concerned that that shouldn't be an issue. Some of committee members have felt that, you know, rather we look at maybe having them away and putting them in prison workshops and all of that. But I think what's important there, the Jali did recommend that when inmates are removed, like what's happening right now, there is no consultation with their family. I know some inmates may not have a good relationship with families, and death in itself is an issue, but inmates are transferred without consultation to family members and to service providers. We would be running a program, a rehabilitation program, that would, where the person would be in the middle of a process, and we're working on certain outcomes. And all of a sudden, with no notification to a service provider, the inmate's not sure because he has been transferred. And I think that issue, it's just disrespectful, for one. And at the same time, it has lots of consequences for the inmate, family relationships. And we know, we said before, family relationships in most instances are key to rehabilitation and to prevent recidivism or reoffending. So if we are talking about rehabilitation, we are in the action. Each one of these challenges are actually counteracting the whole vision that we want to achieve with the rehabilitation and reintegration. So it's almost like, Jali also pointed out, that it's almost like, as a DCS, it is forgotten what the purpose and the goal of it is, and that is rehabilitation and reintegration. And what does reintegration mean? You want to make sure this person does not come back in prison. It's as simple as that. What do I do to make sure this person never comes back to us? And that is an attitude and a mindset that is needed by the entire criminal justice system. Reintegration should not just be at the end of the system, but right at the beginning, even that magistrate or judge making that decision needs to look at the issues of reintegration and how this impacts on that and how imprisonment is going to impact negatively. But, I mean, these are not simple issues, and as I said, it requires a whole culture shift, not only in the department, but in the country. Okay, Jali's Commission, I'm not going to go through it all, but they provide quite useful recommendations with respect to gangs. They talked about the research, they talk about networking with NGOs who have done research in this area, who have skills and competencies in dealing with gangs. They looked at classification and separation of newly awaiting and trial prisoners. They talked about consideration given to dedicated correctional facilities that houses particular gang members. And I've seen this in the US as well, where particular gangs are kept in a particular facility to prevent fights between gangs and all of those kinds of things. They talked about a comprehensive database on prison gangs and gangsters. They talked about linkages with the National Intelligence Agency and the South African Police Service. And I don't think that many of these issues have been looked at. So I would support your recommendation, Chair, to say we need to deliberate on the gang issue a bit more. They also talked about the disciplinary code of conduct, and then is the department making use of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act? It will be interesting to know how many gang members have actually been sentenced or convicted under that. Okay, with regard to the treatment of inmates, the Jali Commission did make a recommendation of a prisoner's disciplinary tribunal, and I'm not sure if that has ever, I haven't noted that has taken place in correctional facilities. But it basically looked at a disciplinary procedure set up for prisoners, which looked at the rights of natural justice, the right to call witnesses, the right to cross-examine, and a whole lot of other things. But, I mean, maybe that's an opportunity to look at that at another time. We talked about retraining warders and amendments of legislation regarding disciplinary issues. The other issue I want to highlight is the issue of health care. And although Jali didn't mention it too specifically, although they mentioned a whole lot on the treatment of offenders, we are concerned that there continues to be a shortage of medical staff, including doctors, nurses, pharmacists, psychologists, as well as challenges to supply and control of drugs, availability of emergency equipment, record keeping, and the state of hospital wings in DCS facilities. These facilities are actually not at all adequate. And on page 22, I actually draw your attention to a recent media report on the 6th of August that said that an inmate was awaiting trial and then released had this to say about the work ethic of wardens. If you are sick, they do not care, especially if you are a foreigner. One woman was dying in the cell. We called the warders, but they said they were busy having breakfast. Then she died. It went on to say that inmates who die in the cell after lockdown are left with the other inmates until morning. If you start getting labor pains and the door is locked, it is locked. You bang on the door for help, they will not open till the following day. The author wrote that the DCS is violating the country's Bill of Rights and Constitution as well as its international human rights obligations. And this is seriously is the plight of inmates in our correctional facilities. We recently, I don't know if the committee remembers, the last time it was, NICRA was looking at an issue of mentally ill in prison. And what we did find out by following up is that we did find that this offender that was housed in Peter Maritzburg Correctional Facility, he was never assessed for a mental illness. He was arrested for housebreaking and received a one-year sentence. He was assigned to the prison hospital, and there was no assessment done until NICRA intervened. And when they assessed, the psychiatrist's assessment was there was no mental issues, but he did suffer from epilepsy. And then a psychologist did an assessment and found that this offender was of low mental functioning. And basically, these types of offenders, they are very vulnerable to exploitation and victimization of prisons. Fortunately, through much lobbying, we were able to have this offender released on parole. And but the key issue is there are people in our centers that have these conditions and that they're not even being assessed. And if one hadn't intervened, they would have been left to languish in prisons. And the psychologist, when I spoke to him, he said they do not have adequate facilities to deal with people who are mentally ill and physically disabled. They said hospital facilities are actually really a joke. It's not at all. And I'm not saying it happens everywhere, but anyway, that's a pertinent issue, and I think the committee can also look at the issue of the hospitals and resourcing of medical facilities in correctional centers. Okay. I think we've discussed extensively about the Judicial Inspectorate of Prisons, and Dali makes very detailed recommendation about the issue of enforcing recommendations and that the inspecting judge obviously functions independently, and the power of the Office of the Inspecting Judge to increase powers of search and seizure to make its work more effective. It also looked at that Chapter 16 of the Correctional Services Act, number 98, should be amended to include a further section that makes it a criminal offense for members of the department to interfere, hinder, or frustrate the officials of the inspecting judge in the performance of their duties. A penalty clause should accompany the criminalization of this conduct like all other criminal offences stated in Chapter 16 of the Correctional Services Act. And I think that deals with the whole issue around cooperation and accountability as well. Okay, then just in conclusion, I think we know that prisoners are also a sector of our democratic society. And if we as a country post this constitution, we have to make sure that those rights are also equally protected in our correctional facilities, like all South Africans. I mentioned that the report has increased the public's awareness of the lives of prisoners, and it does provide a comprehensive analysis of the main problem areas within the DCS. The Dali Commission's investigation also was significant in that it did demonstrate government's commitment to fighting corruption. As much as there have been developments in the country with regard to key issues, like Mr. Munting had pointed out, it's unclear whether these recommendations were accepted by the Department of Correctional Services or not. And interestingly, when I went to the Correctional Services website, I found nothing on the Dali Commission. I tried to find a report or anything, but it's not anywhere on their website under publications or anything. But I assume they wouldn't want to publish it. But anyway, a monitoring tool of some sort that looks at listing these recommendations and debating and refining them, I think, are important. And so that none of them fall through the gap. And that doesn't only apply to Dali Commission, but to all the other investigative reports, the annual reports of the inspecting judge. And I think the Public Services Administration, they did a research as well. Yeah, the Public Service Commission. commission report and the Public Service Administration's investigation report dropped. Those recommendations apparently have not been enforced. Okay, but I think just to, broadly, just to pay attention, when you look at the Jali Commission in its totality, I think important issues are the legislative amendments regarding the judicial inspectorate of prison. I think that's an issue that requires more interrogation and debate. Reporting on the gang management strategy, which I really believe should be a dedicated strategy, and research should go into it, and this committee should report be reported on regarding progress. Addressing the institution of cultural growth and ongoing effort, we need to be committed to building that culture. The issue of poor record keeping and information management affects a lot of things, and it affects security, it affects how we manage offenders, so I think it's a key issue. The increased use of correctional supervision, management of transfers, like I mentioned, and the Jali Commission also points out that cameras should be connected to closed-circuit TVs that can be installed in all communal cells in order to monitor activities. And I actually don't think that is a bad idea. I know we may not want to go the route in budgets, but if cells could be monitored, I mean, in some way it could manage a lot of activity that goes on after lockdown. So that's something that should be given some consideration. Okay, and therefore our recommendations would be to call on the committee to generate a list of these recommendations from these various investigations and get the committee to call the department to look to report on progress and to answer why some of them have not been implemented. And as I said, to generate an ongoing way where we can generate these recommendations, where they evolve, and that it's listed somewhere so that you can follow them properly. Again, I mentioned the judicial inspectorate. Once again, the whole committee is called to look at a cluster report as well on certain issues, and not just the DCS. We would like to call the committee to use this opportunity to look at the issue of mentally ill in our correctional facilities. And and the DCS policy framework on sexual abuse to be implemented and reported on. Yeah, well, that's basically some of the issues we'd like to.
All right. Comment?
Thank you, Chairperson. Also, thank you for the presentation. Chairperson, I want to know from the NIC. On page 5, on the issue of time, where you talk about the rights, the constitutional rights of the prisoners that are evaluated by the officials in terms of closing for the inmate early and eat their supper before time of the supper. I want to get from you, in terms of this 7 days establishment, that what is your view about the 7 days of establishment? Is it working or not? Why I'm asking this question is because we have observed on our oversight that this 7 days establishment is causing lots of problems. There's a shortage of staff because of this 7 days of establishment. And at the very same time, you talk about the master key that master key also is a problem, because if they lock with the master, even the inmate is sick, no one, or is beaten inside in the cell, no one is helping. I want to know from you that what is your view about the master, because this thing of master is not a new system. It's the old system of master that if the master have locked, is locked, it's going to open the next or following day. I want you to tell us more. What is your view? What mechanism can we do to stop that? And at the very same time, there's this shortage of staff. What do you think about the staff? That how many staff must we have at night? Because this is another problem. And this issue of a master, I want to link it with the escape. Also, it looks like it's going together, because this escape also, we have observed that besides on what you are saying, that some inmates are helped by the officials to escape, but also this shortage of staff can cause that escape, because if the one member looking after 100 inmates in one block, then, or two members looking for 100 people or 300 people, these two inmates, these two members, the inmates are clever. They see that, okay, every weekend there's these two people. These other people, they are going to make noise or fight or whatever, think that they can focus on them. Then the one that has planned that, then they get chance to run away. So I want also to get from you, because on your recommendation, you don't assist me about this escape and on what you are saying about the members that are sitting. That one is falling under corruption. But what we need to get here is to get a solution of stopping this escape. Thank you.
Mr. Abraham, I'm going to allow you to ask your questions, and then Mr. Kapula, because it is now 1 o'clock, we are in trouble.
I'll be very short, Chairperson. We've received information that with regard to transfers, an inmate at the Pretoria prison was transferred to Waterfowl without his consent, without having been informed. It just happened. And the researcher received a call, and the researcher then called the head of the prison. And the attitude of the head of the prison was that he does not have to give any explanation to anybody, he doesn't have to consult anybody, he can merely do this. Now, you see, Chairperson, there are always two sides to a coin, whichever way to the egg. And one of the sides are that, yes, if this is the kind of attitude that our officials adopt, and I don't say all of them are like that, there are some excellent officials, then we do expect reactions to come. But there must be a humane approach. There must be an approach where the person is told that you are going to be transferred for overcrowding or whatever reason. Now, this matter is apparently currently with a judicial inspectorate, but it is this kind of thing that I believe the department does not need to be told by way of a resolution, that it should be standard practice, that people need to be treated in a humane way. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, I'm going to ask about this connecting of the
You are connecting the sensitivity on the cell to prevent an escape, or to see the privacy, and it will be always on the pavilion of the official. Is what I want to know, because once you say you connect on the cell, also the issue of light coming in, and then I want to know about it.
Thank you, sir. I'm sorry, I see first light in your public system. But we really don't have time, right?
Very, very briefly. Just having listened to many of the inputs today, I mean, they're obviously very helpful for the inspector to listen to some of the philosophical stuff, some of the general kind of stuff, etc. If I can use those terms loosely. But I also want to say that one, we are very amenable, like we have a relationship with Parliament, who receives complaints and we receive them. And we've established that mechanism of investigating and inquiring into all. I know individual members of Parliament send it to us, and we get them generally. That invitation is extended to NICRO. I've heard of the newspaper report from NICRO now. I'm not aware of that, if that was referred to us ever before. I know Mr. Munting, when he picks up issues, it will be referred to us. So I'm going to make a general call that... And I'm not saying it hasn't happened, but to listen to if these things are tabled at this committee on these kind of occasions and they're general, they give a very skewed picture of what might be generally a problem, but might not be as pervasive as it is. That's my point, and I'm probably the other thing the judge, if he was here, he would say that, and that matter has been heard in a London court. There's a judgment in the Diwani matter. Evidence has been given. There's a transcript, and I'll say this: that when you read the judgment and you read the transcript and you read what the press has said, they're two different things. Right? Of course, I'm not defending it. I mean, there are bad prisons, there are good prisons. But to extrapolate, I'm not saying Mr. Munting has suggested that, but to say, when you something about safe custody, the probability of something happening to you, however high, however low it is, it is there. It's a situation which is not normal. Some prisons, the probability is higher, the others are lower. And all I implore is to the committee, to people who pick up things on the ground, is one, refer it to us, and of course hold us accountable if we don't follow it up. On the other hand, I implore to be a little tempered with regard to the 99.9% of inmates when they enter the prison will be raped. I probably reflect the judge's views again. If there's evidence to that effect, I mean, of course. So perhaps those who have heard about our South African prisons and researchers have written about it, etc. We're not saying that lots of the general statements made about our country's 239 prisons may not be true in particular instances. But to extrapolate this to mean something else creates a very false picture. Now, when I say that, and I just want to add this caveat that there are bad prisons. We've reported on them. We've criticized them. We will continue to criticize them. But perhaps I just want to enjoin those here to be evidence-based to as far as possible. And if some of the things that were said here were never raised before, then I'm saying those who have raised it, you have had a duty to raise it in a more formal manner. Thank you, Chair.
Now, this is the formal manner, sir. All these people are invited by us, they're our stakeholders. Your own private business in Cape Town or anywhere else is your problem, but this is a very formal place to raise it. I don't know, but if you want to have a relationship with the inspecting judge or anybody else, that's fine. So I thought I might do that. Mamela, I'm going to say this thing slowly. I will come to you, sir. I'm going to say this thing slowly so that you guys benefit from it. On the 7th of September, we are going to ask you about the balance between internal and external appointments. We are going to talk about the commitment to redirect your budget. If we are saying the Zali Commission talks to service delivery on the ground, then there must be resources on the ground. We are going to have a discussion around the inspecting judges' enforcement versus the reporting and investigating. Your views on that, and I think members must also tie their minds around that question. We want to have a discussion around the monitoring tool. Let us elaborate on this monitoring tool that Mr. Lucas talks about. We want to talk about whether, in your view, you think that the department has been hijacked by corruption, corrupt elements, and how much control do you have in your department, or is it a group of inmates and also officials that run the show more than the departments. We're also going to raise the issue around the department's attitude to recommendations. This thing of outside advice is not going to hold in our department. We're going to have a discussion around that. The department's attitude to recommendations, whether it's the Dali Commission, whether it's this committee, but your whole attitude around outside advice. We also want somebody to talk to us about what has happened to the mass assault at St. Albans, if anything was done at all. We also want to have a discussion around the training of staff in terms of the eradication of torture, the whole militarization, demilitarization, the training, what are we doing about it? Especially in terms of the eradication of torture. This is not yours. Maybe it is yours because the inspecting judge is a part of you, but the regular reporting of human rights violations, whether it's the department, whether it's the inspecting judge, somebody or both of you will account to the department. And we want to know what your thoughts are about it and how do you intend doing it. We'll take a decision whether we want it. And maybe very briefly, it's a pity Binamuz is not here, but very briefly around the anti-gang strategy. We're not going to have a discussion, but I am assuring you that before the end of the year, we will have a session where we just discussed that thing. But we want to know, is there a strategy? At what stage is it in? Or is it still a conceptual idea? That type of thing. We will not get into the detail, but we want you guys to come and tell us about your gang management, let's put it that way. Your gang management in facilities. And we'll decide whether we need to elaborate or take it further in the future. And then finally, the whole policy of master key, I'm hearing it for the first time today, but it is serious enough for us to look at the master key versus the need for keys after hours if there's an emergency. Is that just something that is urban legend or does it really work and so on? So those are the minimum things that we are going to require you to discuss. But of course, members will have gone and done their own reading and will add. But if nobody, if everybody else is absent on that day and I'm the only one, expect those 11 questions. All right. Otherwise, members will add to those questions. So we are saying those question members, let's agree that those are minimum questions. Members must come with stuff other than that type of stuff that we want you to add to the table. I am being harassed by the department there. I didn't want the department to engage with us because you're seeing us on the 7th, but Sam, we are going to allow you 2 minutes before we thank everybody that's here, but yeah.
Chairperson of the portfolio committee, members of the portfolio committee, distinguished experts and members of the media. Not going to be long, but I just wanted to say, just so we don't see headlines, you know, talking about things that we really don't agree with. The report by, I think it's Mr. Munting, of course, quoting the source of the inspecting judge, from the inspecting judge report on natural death in our operational centers. The impression given there is that those unnatural deaths are caused primarily by our officials. And that report can be accurate in the sense that some deaths, and I'm sure we'll agree, are caused by inmate violence. Some unnatural costs are caused primarily. result of our negligence in the correctional facility, but simply because of the wound, you know, subsequently. So we just want to make sure that it can be that those unnatural deaths are as a result of our vision, so that even when we report, then the inspecting judge in fact goes to the extent of suspecting that even natural death in our correctional facilities should be post-mortem, but it's not to show whether people die as a result of natural death in there. So I think it's important, Chairperson, just to make sure that we don't get reports saying correctional services officials, you know, freely kill inmates there, and there are no due processes taking place. I think it's more complex than that one. I think the other one, Chairperson, is that even in the House here, I realize that our experts with us here, they still refer to our offenders, inmates, as prison. They still refer to our correctional centers as prison. Now, it's a constitutional imperative that we move from prison to correction. So, yes, they are in our custody, but they are in our custody for corrective measures. And within that context, I'm sure we'll be able to understand that when the minister went traversed the length and breadth of our country talking about renaming some of our correctional centers, so within that corrective sense, that we basically want to show people that we are no longer prison. And, you know, when people are released, they're coming back to us, to the community. So if Chairperson Teresh can just correct that, because we are the agents of change ourselves, but if some of us that still prefer, still think that our offenders are called prisoners, they're no longer prisoners. And if we don't move from that mind shift, we are bound to look at them and say, they don't generally have all the rights that we think they have. And that's what I was saying.
All right. To my friends in the media, from this committee's point of view, you are at liberty to write whatever you want to write. Let me say this, that we are not going to censor you in any way. However, the record will show what we meant, and we can only appeal to all our friends in the media that, please, we are not going to censor what you say or how you say it, but I think our friends from PMG or PGM or whatever you call yourself, part of yours is to take minutes of this. I'm hoping that you will also be able to concur with us when somebody goes out of line and says, no, I was in that meeting. This was the spirit in which it was said. So I think let's be very careful that we don't censor what our friends in the media want to say. But we would be able to defend it tomorrow if it came out as a mischievous or as a incorrect something. I think let's leave it at that rather than directing what should be appearing as headlines in the Citizen or in the Star tomorrow and so on. So I thought I must say that, but yeah, I think Lucas, Ms. Ramagaga and Vanessa, thank you very much. For the first time in a very long time, we're talking politics of correctional services as opposed to the administration. And I really think we need to do this, Mamgwenya, that we discuss the politics of this thing as opposed to coming to lament around the administration of it. So thank you very much. We will at least be able to engage the department on the politics of next week. That there is corruption, we're not going to discuss. What is it that we are doing about it, and how do we fix it up is what we're going to discuss going forward. So thank you very much to all of you. I know that we're never going to have enough time in this department or in this committee to discuss these things because they're just so interesting and they appeal to everybody. Thank you very much. I was just saying to Cindy now, so that members know, on the 7th we had
the seven-day establishment plus the Tally Commission. I don't think that we're going to do justice if we have to. I really don't think we're going to do justice. So we're probably going to have to move one of them to another day, but we can't do 7 days establishment and the Tally Commission on the same day and think that we're making headway. So there will probably be a change on the 7th. Between my boss, Cindy, and Paul, we'll decide which one we're going to have, because both of them are equally important as far as we are concerned. So thank you very much to our friends from the media. Thank you very much to our visitors from Johannesburg. Thank you very much to the department and also to our stakeholders today. Thank you very much. And to members, we then will go and do our homework for the 7th. And we meet again next week with the minister to have a discussion around the state of correctional services, an open meeting with her around the state of nation of PCS. So thank you very much to everybody, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.